This is Audible.
Gildan Audio presents Your Coach in a Box, affordable, life-changing seminars on CD. Kabbalah Works, Awakening to Your Purpose, Passion, and Power. Written and read by Rabbi David Aaron.
The wisdom I'm about to share with you is not mine. I'm merely translating the ancient and profound teachings of the Kabbalah into a language that anyone can understand. But before we begin, it's important to be clear that the Kabbalah is not a religion or an independent tradition. The Kabbalah is an integral part of the divine revelation communicated to the prophet Moses and recorded in the Torah, which I call God's Guide to the Good Life. The Kabbalah reveals the basic truths at the core of our existence. Understanding these truths empowers us to discover our ultimate purpose, awaken our passions for life, and tap into the unlimited resource of power so that we can take action and get results. The Kabbalah answers questions that I'm sure we've all asked. What is the secret to happiness? How does one achieve fulfillment? How does one experience true love? Why is there so much evil and suffering in the world? What is our purpose? Is there really a God? And if there is a God, what does he want from us? The Kabbalah offers the answers to the ultimate questions in our lives. In this series, Kabbalah Works, we're going to explore secrets to purposeful living.
God is your problem and your answer. How your beliefs make or break your life. How much does your perception of God really matter? Many of us aren't aware of our image of a higher power. For some of us, God is a judgmental parent or an exacting old man in the sky. For others, God is an imaginary friend who is there to fix problems after we create them. By drawing on teachings of Kabbalah that were secrets for a millennia, David Aaron helps you discover a mature and empowering understanding of God. Reclaim the power you've given away to negative images of God or passive images of yourself. Tap the wellspring of the divine power within you. These mystical secrets offer guidance, meaning, and purpose to the lives of people of all faiths.
Quite frankly, I've struggled with God my whole life. As a child, I was quite a worried type. I remember seeing many shows on television, challenging shows about people being pursued or people being spied on or people being hurt. And there was all these spy shows and criminal shows and a couple of comedies also. But even the comedies seemed to be about bad things happening in a comical way to people. And I, as a child, was quite a nervous little boy and worried. I recall my parents going out and telling me they'd come home at 8 o'clock. And when it got close to 8, I started to get really nervous. I mean, but really nervous. And I know it's probably not so normal, but that's how I felt. So I used to, of course, when a person's nervous, they go into the bathroom. That's where I went. Went to the bathroom. And in the bathroom, I poured out my guts to God. I would pray to God. I would bargain with God. And I would say, God, if you bring my parents home, I'll be the best little kid in the world. And there from the bathroom window, I could look out onto the street and anxiously wait for my parents to come home. And, you know, sure enough, my parents would come home at 8:05, sometimes at 8, but 8:05, 8:10. And sometimes I would feel that God tricked me, that he stalled my parents to get the better end of the bargain because I committed to do all these good things for my parents to come home and be protected. But as I grew up, I started to feel resentful that I always had to bargain with God and come up with these deals with God. And at a certain point in my life, I decided that I can't believe in this God. And yet, as much as I decide I can't believe in this God, I nonetheless continue to fear him. Many of us have struggles with God. Who is God? What does he want from us? I remember a cute comic strip, Calvin and Hobbes. Hobbes, of course, is the toy tiger, and Calvin is the little boy, and they have these little interesting discussions between them. Hobbes turns to Calvin and says, "Calvin, do you believe in God?" Now, Calvin's got this kind of philosophical look on his face, and he says, "Well, somebody's out to get me." And, you know, for the last 25 years, I've been involved in education, and I've had the opportunity to really help counsel hundreds, if not perhaps thousands of people. And I've found it to be a common thread amongst many people that people are suffering a phobia that I think we could call theophobia. Theophobia is this intense fear of God. One of the workshops that I do in our center, Israelite, in Jerusalem, I do a workshop where I have people write letters to God. And in fact, I ask them to write the letters with their non-dominant hand to simulate the writing of childhood, because I want to somehow inspire them to access memories that they had as a child. And basically, the letters start like this: "Dear God, I always wanted to ask you," and then just see what happens. Of course, writing with your non-dominant hand, you're writing like a child, and you begin to really some of the childhood memories people have with God. What's so fascinating about these letters is almost all these letters are dump on God letters. "Dear God, I always wanted to ask you, why did you take my grandfather away from me? Dear God, I always wanted to ask you, why are there so many wars and so many people being killed today?" Very rarely would I hear a positive letter to God. In fact, I recall one woman who did, in fact, write a very positive letter to God. She said, "Dear God, I always wanted to ask you, why do you love me so much? How did you make the butterflies so beautiful? How did you infuse the flowers with so much fragrance?" And as she was reading this incredibly upbeat, positive, loving, warm letter to God, people in the room started to giggle. People started to feel uncomfortable. And that was really a shock to me. How not only do so many people live with, harbor these negative feelings and associations with God, but they even find it somewhat comical that somebody does. In one of my workshops, I asked the participants to simply do a free association. I'll say, "God, childhood, what comes to your mind?" Well, so one woman shoots up her hand immediately, and she says, "I can't believe it. I don't think I've remembered this story perhaps since it happened. It's amazing how this came to me so immediately. I don't know what I did wrong, but I recall my mother yelling at me, 'God's going to punish you. God's going to punish you.' And my mother, I guess in the name of God, starts running after me, and she's going to punish me, of course, in the name of God. So running away from my mother, I ran into the bathroom. And I locked the door. My mother started banging on the door. 'You bad girl, come out, because God's going to punish you. You bad girl, come out, God's going to punish you.' Well, to that, I answered, 'No, no, he's not, because I'm in the bathroom, and he can't get me here.' And to that, my mother responded, 'Oh, you silly girl, God is everywhere, even in the bathroom.'" Now, can you imagine? Could you imagine a little girl having to be in the bathroom and her mother telling her that God is so mean that he runs after little girls even in the toilet? You're not even free in the bathroom. This was the story this woman shared. Everyone in the room had a kind of like a whoa, you know? And I then began to understand this woman a lot better, because this woman, when I first met her, told me that she's an atheist. And you know what? Now that I heard this story, I was happy she was an atheist. Because I'd rather her not believe in a God who's so mean that he chases little girls into the toilet than believe in such a horrible God. And I want you to know that this, unfortunately, is common. Now, perhaps not all of you listening to this have these associations with God. But I have found over and over again that deep within many people's subconscious, there's baggage. And in order to take a true spiritual journey, you've got to get off the guilt trip and embrace a mature understanding of the divine. You know, imagine if you were to base your diet on food as you understood food as a child. What would you be eating today? You'd probably be eating junk. And imagine if you were to base your budget on your understanding of money as a child. What would you be spending your money on? Probably junk. So imagine if you were to base your spiritual life, your relationship with God, based on your understanding of God as a child. What would it be? Maybe it would be junk. You know, I recall one Friday night, I was sitting with my children, my wife, having our traditional Shabbat meal. And one of the common traditions in our home is that the children present the art that they had done that week in school. And so my daughter at the time, a little girl, perhaps 5 or 4 years old, she's showing us a picture that she drew. And, you know, the pictures were generally quite consistent. There was the sun with a big smiley face, a big yellow sun. It's so beautiful how children know that the sun is smiling. And then there was the house, which was smaller than the people. And then there was stick figures of the people, and you can always tell who daddy is because daddy's got the curly orange hair. And there was the flower that was bigger than the people and the house. But in this particular picture, in the sky was floating a purple-green guy. And as my daughter was pointing out the various characters and things in the picture, she clearly was veering away from the purple-green guy in the sky. Well, you know, after a while, she couldn't avoid it. I said to her, Nemo, and who's this? And she continued to find other things to say about the picture. But at that point, there was really nowhere to hide. She really had no one left to explain but that purple-green guy in the sky. So she wanted to tell me in secret, quietly, so the other children wouldn't hear. But of course, as I come closer and she's whispering into my ears, the other children push in to try and understand, well, what's she saying? Come on, who is that guy? What's she saying? And so she says to me, quietly whispering, she says, it's God. What? It's God. But you know what? The other kids heard, and my little son said, what? You drew God? You can't draw God? That's forbidden. You drew God? You can't draw God? Well, my daughter was so flustered, she grabbed her picture. She ran out of the room. She said, I can draw God if I want to. I can draw God if I want to. Now imagine my daughter now in her 20s. And imagine, of course this would be ridiculous, but imagine that she actually continues to think that God is a green guy floating in the sky. A green guy floating in the sky. Of course, I would hope she wouldn't believe in God. And that would be healthy. In fact, that would be very sick if she did believe that God is a green guy in the sky. Now, for sure, nobody thinks that God is a green guy in the sky. But there are some people that still have some sense. Some sense that God is some being floating in outer space or floating in some heavenly realm. And, of course, we all know, surely he doesn't have a long white beard, but with no other way to depict it in our minds, I think many of us are harboring these kinds of childish images, crystallized image. I remember another funny little incident where my three children, my two daughters and my son, came into my study. They'd obviously been having some kind of argument. You go. No, you go. No, you ask Daddy. No, you ask Daddy. Okay, my son steps forward. I will ask Daddy. Okay, so my son steps forward. He says, Daddy, we're having a very serious argument. Now, remember, these are little children, maybe 8, 9, 7, 6, whatever, but little children. My son says, Daddy, isn't it true that God is a boy? And I see my daughters going, oh, no, please, no. I could just see their eyes welling up in tears. No, don't make him a boy. It's bad enough our brother is a boy. Well, I turn to my children. I say, sweeties, God isn't a boy. And my girls go, yippee. Well, wait a second. But God isn't a girl. My son goes, ha-ha. Well, no, you don't understand. God is not a boy, and God is not a girl. God is beyond male or female. Now, my children were in utter shock. They did not know what to do with this. My son really is very disturbed. He steps forward and he says, Daddy, you're wrong. God is a boy. And he runs out of the room. Now, of course, when we open the Bible and we see so many associations with God as male, I can understand people are very challenged. But I want you to understand that the tradition, the Jewish ancient wisdom of the Torah and the Kabbalah, make it very clear that God is beyond male and beyond female. And why is the divine generally described as male in the Bible? That's a topic for another time. But it's important to understand that as we mature, our understanding of God needs to mature. Otherwise, we will spiritually remain as little naive children, and we will be missing the power, the inspiration, the life force of a genuine connection with God. I recall a cute story. I was studying Torah and Kabbalah with the legendary actor Kirk Douglas. He shared with me something so telling. He said that when he was a child, he remembered going to Hebrew school, and he remembered learning the story of Abraham and the near sacrifice of his son Isaac, how God asked Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac. Now, understandably, again, I don't know how the teachers presented it, but understandably, as a child, he was very deeply disturbed. And it is a very deeply disturbing story if one doesn't understand the depth of it. But Kirk shared with me, I said to myself, really, if God were to ask my father to sacrifice me, then he would have gladly done it. And if God would have jumped in there and said, no, stop, he would have said, too late. Many of us are holding on to all kinds of stuff with God. But the time has come whereby God should no longer be the problem, but that we can finally discover how God is the answer to all our problems. But that can only happen if we have a paradigm shift and can finally maturely not just understand, but deeply experience the true meaning of a connection to our Maker, to the source of all of creation. Now, when I brought my first book to the publisher with the hopes that perhaps they'd be interested, the president of this company said something very fascinating. He said, Rabbi, a couple of years ago, I would not have looked at a book like this. A book about God wouldn't sell. But what can I tell you? The market's changed and God is in. And in fact, the market has changed, and God is in. But how do we get God into our lives in a real way, in a mature, empowering way? How can we embrace a connection to the divine that will really bring us happiness, and really fill our lives with purpose, passion, and true joy. As I mentioned earlier, most people think that God is some being floating in outer space over there. In fact, I recall the first Russian cosmonaut, that's Russian for astronaut, when he was in his spaceship. Ground control asked him, "What do you see?" He responded, "Well, I don't see God." He didn't see God. I mean, what did he expect to see? Did he think that some way, somehow, he'd be floating along, zooming along in his spaceship, and suddenly he'd see these two huge eyes peering at him?
"Hi, I'm God. What took you so long?"
I mean, what did he think he would see? Unfortunately, I've met many people who actually think that God is being floating in outer space, and that somehow that almighty, infinite, eternal God created you and me. Now imagine the image of such a paradigm. There's God in reality, and that almighty, infinite God created you and me also in reality. Well, how would we feel with that kind of image of God? Next to the infinite, I feel infinitesimal. Next to the infinite, I feel infinitesimal. Next to the eternal, I feel so temporal. Next to the almighty, I feel all puny, or I feel all weak. I mean, most people have this image of this huge God. And next to that huge God, we feel so tiny. We feel itsy bitsy teeny weeny. I mean, we feel like nothing next to that God. So, when most of us are seeking to feel good about ourselves, seeking to feel inspired, feeling motivated, feeling confident, when we have this idea of this almighty, all-powerful, infinite, eternal God standing next to us, almost as if breathing down our necks, what are we supposed to feel? And then on top of this, this God has all these commandments that feel so restrictive, that feel so disempowering. We feel more like demands than commands. And so how am I supposed to feel in the presence of this kind of a God who is so overwhelmingly great and so perfect, before whom next to I feel so overwhelmingly small and so imperfect? And on top of this, God has asked of me to all do all these deeds, and he's constantly judging me. And who knows, maybe he'll run after me to get me even in the toilet if I do something wrong. This kind of a God is a problem, and this kind of a God you must not believe in. Because this kind of God doesn't exist. This is a figment of our imagination. This is a leftover of childish, naive attitudes towards the divine. And where we got these ideas is not the issue right now. The issue is, how do we rid ourselves of this spiritual baggage that is weighing us down and discover the true and the ancient truth about the divine? So I like to shock my students by telling them that, in fact, I really don't believe in God. And I know that's really quite hard to believe. How could a rabbi not believe in God? But I actually go another step. The truth is that Moses didn't believe in God. Because the truth is, if you open up the Torah in the original language it was written, Hebrew, you'll never, ever see the word God. God is not the word for the divine, according to the Torah, the ancient Jewish wisdom, and certainly according to the Kabbalah, the commentary on that wisdom. In fact, I don't believe in some being floating in outer space over there, but rather I believe in what Jewish wisdom teaches, what was revealed to Moses, the ultimate divine name, Yud Hey Vav Hey. The Hebrew letters Yud Hey Vav Hey. What do those letters suggest? What does that word suggest? Now, when you open up a Bible that's translated into English, well, then you're going to see a translation of Lord or God. But translation can always be misleading. It's not uncommon that something gets lost in translation. The truth is that the word Yud Hey Vav Hey actually is a word that emerges out of a combination of Hebrew words. One word is Havaya, which means existence or reality. Another word is Haya, which means was. Hoveh, which means is. Yihyeh, which means will be. In fact, the word that is used to suggest the divine, our creator, our sustainer, the word used is a word which is a combination of reality, was, is, and always will be. In other words, what we believe in other words, what Torah tradition, ancient Jewish wisdom teaches us, is not that there's some God floating in outer space, but rather to believe in the ultimate timeless reality. The one who was, the one who is, the one who always will be. There's no such thing as a God in reality, because when we say God, or actually when we say the Yud, the He, the Vav, the He, which is actually pronounced Adonai, when we say Adonai, what we're really referring to is reality itself, the ultimate reality, which was, is, and always will be. There's no such thing as a reality, and in reality there's God, and in reality there's you and me, and you and me are standing next to this big God, and we're all sharing a big room called reality. Rather, the ultimate timeless reality, the reality which was, is, and always will be, the reality wherein you and I exist this very second, is what is referred to as Adonai. Actually, in Jewish tradition, rather than saying Adonai, which is what we would say during prayer or the study of the Torah, the five books of Moses, we simply say Hashem, which simply means the name, because we actually don't want to become too familiar with any word suggesting the divine, because the divine is beyond our comprehension. And we need to understand that the divine is the ultimate reality wherein which we exist. You know, Passover, one of the great holidays in Jewish tradition, there is actually a song in the Passover Haggadah, which is recited Passover night. Baruch Hamakom Baruch Hu. One of the terms used to describe the divine is Hamakom. Hamakom means the place, the all-embracing place where in which we exist. In other words, even if a person were to believe in the Big Bang Theory, that there was some original gases or molecules or electrons or whatever, particles, and there was some kind of collision, some kind of Big Bang, the question we still need to ask is, where did that happen? There's an assumption. The assumption is there is a reality, and within that reality, something happened. But what is that reality? Or actually, Kabbalah and Jewish tradition would say, who is that reality? You see, if I think that God is a being floating in outer space, and I'm a being floating in outer space, next to that God I feel like nothing. Now, if I don't want to feel like nothing, then I have a choice. I can either get rid of God and feel like something, or I can create some religious philosophy that espouses that I really am nothing and that my spiritual aspirations should be to experience myself as if I'm nothing. But if you're not prepared to feel like nothing and you're not willing to believe that beyond yourself is nothing, that God is nothing, well, then I present to you the secrets of the Kabbalah. That when we say God and we actually don't say God, when we say Hashem, when we say the Yud, the He, the Vav, the He, pronounced Adonai, what we're really referring to is the ultimate reality wherein which you and I exist. Now I want you to realize the incredible paradigm shift that the Kabbalah is revealing. Because what the Kabbalah is actually teaching us is that you and I don't exist alongside of God, but we actually exist within God, or actually within Hashem, to be more correct. I say to be more correct because so many people now identify God as that being floating in outer space. But if you can get past that childish imagery and begin to embrace God as the ultimate timeless reality wherein which you and I exist, suddenly you don't exist next to God, feeling small, insignificant, nothing. But now the Kabbalah reveals that you exist within God. And now you and I are part of God, one with God, connected to God every single moment of our lives, right here, right now. That is a mind-boggling concept, and it's even more overwhelming when you begin to experience this truth that you and I exist within God. Now, when I share this idea with people, people get a little worried. Reality, that really God is reality, or reality is what we call God, reality sounds too impersonal. What do I pray to reality? Reality cares about me. Reality is interested in me. But why do we assume that the ground context, source, foundation, and essence of our existence is any less than us? Surely it's more reasonable to assume that the ground context, that the ultimate reality wherein which we exist, that supports us, is infinitely greater than us. And therefore, Hashem, Yud Hey Vav Hey, ultimate timeless reality, is no less loving, no less caring, no less intelligent, no less feeling than you and I, because the ultimate reality, God, is the context, the ground and the source of all of love and all of wisdom, all of life and all of beauty. Surely ultimate reality is personal, no less personal than you and I who exist within Hashem. The metaphor offered to understand or appreciate this incredible mystery is the metaphor of a relation between the thinker and the thought. Imagine right now a man in your mind. Create a man in your mind, not someone you know, someone that you don't know. Create a man in your mind. Where does that man exist? Within your mind. Is that man you? No. Are you that man? No. Is that man a part of you? Yes. If you stop thinking of that man, are you missing a part? No. It's a mystery. So too, our relationship to God, to Hashem, as the thought is to the thinker, we are to God. We exist within the divine, and we are an expression of the divine. We are not the divine. We are not the thinker. We are the thought. But we are one with God, and God is one with us. We exist within God, and God is expressed and manifest through us. And now, the purpose of our lives, as the great Hasidic master, the Baal Shem Tov, reveals, is to realize that we, each and every one of us, is in fact a manifestation of the divine. Our goal is to think, speak, and act in a way that is in harmony with who we really are. What the Kabbalah is teaching us is the goal of life is to simply be who we are and experience who we are and treat each other in the loving and respectful way that is deserving of who we are. We exist within the divine, and the divine is expressed, seeks to become expressed through us. You might be familiar with the famous story of Adam and Eve in the garden and the tree of knowledge of good and bad. After they ate of the tree of knowledge of good and bad, God asks Adam and Eve the ultimate question, a question we will all be asked at some point in our spiritual journey. That question is, where are you? Now, obviously, God knows everything, and therefore, surely this was not a geographical question to know location. Where are you? But rather, it was a spiritual question. Where are you? Why would you do other than my will if you knew the truth of where are you? Because what is the answer to where are you? The answer is, I, God, am in you. And if I really understood that I exist within the divine, and the divine seeks to become manifest through me, why in the world would I do other than the divine will? Why would I do other than the divine will? Only because somehow I've been confused to think that God is a being over there, and I'm over here, and he wants me to do something, but I don't want to do what he wants me to do. And there's some kind of competition going on over here. But when you grasp, and actually you can't really grasp, but when you begin to sense and experience this incredible Kabbalistic truth, that God is not a being floating over there, but that you and I exist within the divine. You and I exist within God, and God seeks to become expressed through us. Then, to accord our will to the divine will is deeply empowering. To live our life in service is the most fulfilling, self-fulfilling. Now, I remember I tried to explain this to my son when he was a child, when he was maybe 8 or 9. I asked him, Nuri, where is God? And he said, in heaven. And he kind of, with his hand, he threw his hands up to heaven. And I said, And Nuri, where are you and I? He says, well, we're here on earth. So I said, you know, Nuri, it's really not that way. The truth is, God is not in heaven, but the truth is that you and I exist within God. In fact, the whole world exists within God. Well, my son was shocked. Imagine a little boy, this is just totally earth-shattering. And he's thinking and he's trying to digest what his father just said. And then, suddenly, his eyes grow wide and he says, oh my gosh, I get it, I get it, I can't believe it. I said, you got it? He says, yeah, I got it. Wow, God is so fat. And of course I realized, how does a child deal with such abstractities? In his mind, there's reality. And now there, rather than God in reality, and we're standing next to God or existing next to God in reality, suddenly he sees God in reality and we're in the belly of God. God is so fat. But that's the child's mind, and we can't expect a child to be so different. But as we merge, as we mature, we need to understand that God is not a being floating in outer space, and we do not exist alongside this almighty, eternal, infinite God, and we have absolutely no reason to feel infinitesimal, temporal, transient, or all puny. Because the truth is, there is no such God, and one who believes in such a God is actually a heretic. In fact, one of the great Kabbalists explain that there are heretics that are true believers, and there are believers who are true heretics. A believer actually believes that God is male, floating in heaven, perhaps with some long white beard, seeking to punish us with his lightning bolts. Such a believer is actually a heretic. But a heretic who says, I can't believe in a male God who floats in outer space, such a person is truly a believer, at least a step towards true belief. The Kabbalah reveals to us the ancient truth revealed to Moses and the Israelites at Mount Sinai. The ancient truth. There is no such God floating in outer space. Rather, there is Hashem, Adonai, Yud, He, Vav, He. Havaya, reality. Haya, was. Hoveh, is. Yiyeh, will be. The ultimate timeless reality. You and I exist within the divine as a thought exists within the mind of a thinker. We are one with God and God is one with us. We exist within the divine and the divine seeks to become expressed through us. God is the problem and God is the answer. God is the problem in our lives. If we think God is some being floating outer space, seeking to punish us, trying to hurt us, constantly judging us, then God is the problem. We'll feel small, we'll feel insignificant, we'll feel insecure, we'll feel neurotic, we'll feel depressed. We need to get rid of that kind of a God. But God is the answer. Because if there is no God, and then we're just an accident, and we just came out of nowhere, and we're going nowhere, well then that kind of belief is also a problem. God is the answer. When a person experiences that the reality wherein which we exist is not a what, but a who. The reality is caring, reality is loving, reality is intelligent. Reality, the source, the ground, the context, the essence, the soul of all soul, the soul of your soul. You and I exist within the divine. And divine seeks to become manifest through us. When you experience this truth, life has a dramatic change. You realize that the divine is always with you. You realize the divine is always rooting for you. You realize there is nothing, absolutely nothing you can do to separate yourself from the divine, from the ultimate. However, there is much you can do to separate yourself in mind from the divine. There's much that you can do to confuse yourself and forget this incredible truth. But when we live a lifestyle, when we think, speak, and act in a way that would be comparable to who we are, existing within the divine, as expressions of the divine, when we experience the powers within us and know that although they're within us, they are not from us, but we are connected to an ultimate power, then our lives will be filled with great joy, vitality, creativity, and inspiration. Now, all this might sound great, but how can we go from an intellectual understanding about God to knowing God directly and experientially and benefiting from the power of that experience? Before you can know God, you must first know yourself, who you really are. In our next talk, we explore the real you.
You 101, opening new doors to joyous self-awareness. The secret to success in everything in your life, love, happiness, creativity, is you. If you can get into the driver's seat of your life, you can take charge and become the master of your destiny rather than a victim of your fate. Kabbalah Works gives you the keys to unlock the new doors of self-knowledge and release the unlimited abundance within you. When you courageously venture into your inner space to face yourself, you will ultimately come to know God directly. Awakened to finally experience a personal connection to God, you are at last able to receive God's love unconditionally and discover your ultimate identity, divine purpose, and true happiness.
I know that you're going to be very interested in this next talk. How do I know that? Because I'm going to talk about you. Now, how can I talk about you? I don't know you. Well, let me share with you what the Kabbalah says about who the real you is and who the real I is. A number of years ago, I had over one of my students for Friday night dinner. And we were chatting. She mentioned a few things about her background, and somehow she said something about her mother being in Japan. Well, that was interesting. I said, well, what's your mother doing in Japan? She said, oh, she's looking for herself. Now, that's quite a common phrase. We're all familiar with hearing someone look for themselves. But for my children who are Israeli, they really were quite shocked by what this girl shared about her mother. They couldn't understand it. My children are Israeli. They understand English, but not so well. So when they hear English, they have to quickly translate that into Hebrew in their minds. Kind of like when I hear Hebrew, I have to kind of quickly translate it into English in my mind. So my children hear this very odd phrase that they're trying to translate in their mind. Her mother's looking for herself in Japan. Well, my daughter said, Daddy, what did she say? What did she say? So I now take this very common phrase, and now I have to translate it into Hebrew. Well, Ima Shala, her mother, he ba Japan, she's in Japan, vihi mecha peset et etzma, and she's looking for herself. At that moment, my children had the most shock look on their face. What? And suddenly I was able to get into the mind of a child and realize how absolutely ridiculous this sounds. I mean, what do you mean you looking for yourself in Japan? I mean, if you're not here, then where are you? I mean, what happened? Her mother was in like a hotel and checked out, realized, oh my gosh, I think I left myself in the room. So she runs back to the reception and says, excuse me, I think I left myself in the room. Oh, we're sorry, ma'am. The room was already cleaned out. You cleaned out? I mean, I think I left myself in the room. Well, we're sorry, ma'am, but that room has been cleaned out already. I mean, it could be in the lost and found, but oh, I see. It's already 5 o'clock. Well, you'll have to come tomorrow, but I can't come tomorrow. I left myself in the room. I mean, what does it mean to lose yourself? What does it mean to find yourself? Who are you? Well, you know, this isn't so uncommon. Not just about losing and finding yourself, but people talk about liking themselves. Or people talk about disliking themselves. Now, who is the you that's liking yourself? How can you be both the subject and the object of the same sentence? I mean, people talk about, I'm going to take myself out, treat myself. Well, and who pays for the dinner? What does it mean? Who are you? Who are really? Who are you? Now, not only do people talk about liking themselves or disliking themselves, but people even can hurt themselves. Now, once again, who is trying to hurt who? Punish themselves. Who is trying to punish who? A number of years ago, I was in a supermarket in Manhattan, and there was a fellow in the supermarket who was either drunk or high, and he was yelling, I'm going to kill myself. I'm going to kill myself. I'm going to kill myself. The sad thing was that nobody paid obvious attention to him. They pay attention, but not obvious attention. You know, this man is screaming, I'm going to kill myself. And the woman standing in front of me waiting to pay at the cashier, she says, excuse me, could you pass the cool cigarettes, please? I mean, like, you're the guy screaming he's going to kill himself. Well, the policeman comes over to him and tries to calm him down and says, now, shh, buddy, quiet. What are you doing? What are you saying? He says, well, I'm going to kill myself. So the policeman, and of course everyone's from the entire supermarket is listening. The policeman says, now, what you going to do that for? So the drunken man thinks and he says, well, because my mama hates me and my papa hates me and quite frankly, I hate me. So when I kill myself, I'll be happy. Yeah, that's right. I'm going to be real happy when I kill myself. Now, the policeman says to him, now, wait a second, listen to what you're saying. It doesn't make any sense. He says, well, why not? He says, because If you kill yourself, you're going to be dead. Yeah. And if you're dead, how will you know you're happy? You're dead. Well, this drunken man cannot figure out what are you talking about? You mean if I kill myself, I'm going to be dead? He said, that's right. And if I'm dead, how will I know I'm happy? I'm dead? And the policeman says, that's right. He goes, oh man, I can't even kill myself and be happy. Humorous, but true, but sad. Who did he think would survive his suicide? And yet somehow this drunken man intuited something about himself, which actually, from the Kabbalah, is somewhat true. Because this man intuited that there is a self that transcends the particular me, the persona, and that I could somehow live on. Woody Allen has a cute little joke. He says, well, I'm not afraid of death. I just don't want to be there when it happens. Who will not be there when it happens? Perhaps as a child, you once asked this question. I know I did. Did you ever ask yourself, who would I have been if my mother would have married another man? Now, maybe you never asked that question, but can you relate to such a question? What do you mean, who would I have been if my mother would have married another man? You would not have been you. And yet the child intuits, I remember when I asked that question, that I intuited that there is a self, that I am David Aaron, short little red-headed kid, Jewish, born in Toronto. But maybe if my mother would have married another man, then maybe I would have been tall. Maybe I would have had black hair. Maybe I would have had blue eyes. Maybe I would have had different talents. Maybe would have lived in a different place. There is this deep sense of a self that transcends the persona, the personality, the character that I'm playing. In other words, what the Kabbalah reveals to us is that the self is the soul. And that when people talk about my body, my soul, it's actually a little bit misleading because you don't really have a soul, but you actually are a soul. And as a soul, you come into this world to play a role. You and I are like an actor. An actor is given a part to play, a character to play. But the actor is not the character, but rather plays the character, plays the part. But the actor is not the part. So too, the Kabbalah reveals to us that you are a soul, and you come into this world to play a role. And somehow we all intuit that we could in fact play or have played a different role. In fact, my neighbor, she shared with me with a kind of funny story how she had rebuked her daughter, who was 5 years old at the time. The little girl didn't really appreciate her mother's rebuke. So sternly, she looked back at her mother and said, next time, when you're my daughter and I'm your mother, you're in big trouble. Now, how does a little girl intuit the possibility of such an exchange in roles? How does a little girl intuit the possibility of a next time? And yet the Kabbalah reveals a great wisdom. Yet the Kabbalah reveals deep secrets about reincarnation. In fact, the great Kabbalist, Rabbi Isaac Luria, commonly referred to as the Arizal, he has a book called Gilgul Neshamot, The Recycling of the Souls. And it's quite an extensive wisdom on coming back. So the Kabbalah reveals that, in fact, there is something called reincarnation. But what does it mean, reincarnation? I, David Aaron, am not coming back. But then again, if you got this, you realize that I'm not David Aaron. I'm actually playing David Aaron. David Aaron is a character that I play. David Aaron, the rabbi, the author, the public speaker, David Aaron from Toronto, Canada, David Aaron, the family man, the father, the husband, David Aaron who lives in Jerusalem. That's a character that I play. But please don't get confused. I'm not David Aaron. I play David Aaron, just as an actor plays his part. And it's very possible that if I need to come back after I die, which we'll discuss in a later talk, if I need to come back, then I will play another part. In fact, we are given exactly the part that we need to play to realize who we are as souls and what is our connection to the soul of all souls, the all-embracing reality, God. So the truth is that you don't have a soul, but you are a soul. And as a soul, you come into this world to play a part. That's why there is something to be said for astrology, although Jewish ancient tradition discourages us from exploring astrology. But there are references to astrology in the great Jewish work called the Talmud. The Talmud actually says some very fascinating things about our relationship to the astrological signs. In fact, the Talmud says that if a person was born at the time of Mars, the planet Mars, then that person would have a bloodthirsting character. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean that I don't have free choice? Does that mean that I come into this world and I have no choice but to be bloodthirsty? Well, yes and no, because you have no choice about playing a bloodthirsty character. But your choice is, how will you play that character? My wife, many, many years ago, before she immersed herself in Jewish tradition, was very interested in astrology. And she asked a very poignant question to her teacher. In astrology, there's a phenomena called astrological twins. These are two people that are born at the same time, in the same vicinity, and therefore really have the same astrological sign. And they are referred to as astrological twins. Now, I've seen pictures of astrological twins, and it is absolutely remarkable. These people look like identical twins, and yet there is absolutely no family or blood relation whatsoever. They are astrological twins. So the question is obvious. If we're both given the same map, if we're both given the same character traits, that's been fated to us. Well, then really, where does our choice play in? So my wife's astrological teacher, also well-versed in Jewish wisdom, she explained astrology has nothing to say about your soul, but rather about your character. But you are a soul and you come into this world to play a character. And as a soul, you are free to determine what you want to do with your character traits. And this is, in fact, what the Talmud says. A person who was born and at the time of the sign of Mars, well, then they will be a bloodthirsty character. But then again, what do you choose to do with that character? You could choose to become a serial murderer. Or you could choose to become a surgeon. Both are deeply involved in blood, but one fixing and healing, and the other destroying and hurting. So we do come into this world with character traits, but what you do with those character traits, as a soul, you can choose. You're given perhaps five colors. What you draw with those five colors will be completely different than someone else who's got the exact same five colors. This is very important to understand, that as a soul, you are free to do what you want to do with your character, but there is something fated about your character. There is a story about a fellow who goes to a spiritual master and says, "Master, what is the secret of life?" The master says, "Wood, wires, and nails." Well, that's what you get when you ask these kind of spiritual questions. Wood, wires, and nails. Oh, great. Well, what does that mean? And the master said, "Ponder this, and you shall know." Well, so the fellow went out to ponder wood, wires, and nails, and he basically ended up with nothing. Frustrated, he decided to give up the pursuit and go on with his life. Many, many years later, this fellow sitting on his veranda. It's a beautiful evening, full moon, a warm breeze, and he suddenly hears this beautiful guitar music playing in the distance, enchanting music. So he follows his ear, and there he sees a fellow sitting there on a park bench, playing his guitar in the moonlight. And as he's enjoying the beautiful music, suddenly he realized wood, wires, and nails, the secret of life. What is the secret of life? Suddenly he realized that that guitar is made of wood, wires, and nails. And with wood, wires, and nails, you could create a musical instrument. But with wood, wires, and nails, you could create a weapon. You choose what you want to do with the role that you play. You know, when Shakespeare said, "All the world's a stage and all the men and women are merely players. They have their entrance and exits." He was not off. He was quite on. The Kabbalah teaches that, in fact, we do come into this world and we play a part. But what does it mean to be lost? Why would someone go to Japan to look for themselves? Or why would I go to Jerusalem to look for myself? How does one look for themselves? Who is the self that I'm looking for? Well, am I looking for my soul, the self, or am I looking for my persona, my character, my role? You have to know what you're looking for. When a person says they feel lost, well, they need to kind of qualify, what do they mean when they say lost? You see, some people just don't know what their character is. They just don't know what their talents are. They don't know what their weaknesses are. They really don't know their character traits well enough. Well, so such people could possibly go to graphology, or they might go to career counseling. And that could be very helpful to get them to understand what are the basic character traits that make up their persona. And that would be one kind of loss. I just don't know what my role is in the world. But there's another kind of lost. And in certain ways, it's actually a much, much more painful kind of lost. And that's when the soul, when you get lost in your character. And rather being the master of your character, you become a slave, a victim of your character. Rather being in the driver's seat of your life, driving your role as a soul, you're somewhere on the hood or on the bumper or maybe somewhere in the baggage, but you're not at the driver's wheel of your life. Because now your role is controlling you as a soul. Now, what I mean by that is that people get lost in their role. I'll give you an example. I remember meeting a fellow who's a multi-millionaire. In fact, you know, he's probably a billionaire. This fellow has a private jet. He flies to more country than I walk blocks in one day, meeting decision makers. I mean, he's a well-known, powerful man. And I was lucky to have a short meeting with him and discuss a matter that I wanted his guidance on. And after the meeting, I accompanied him to his limousine. As we were walking, I turned to this fellow, and I have to understand, I don't really know him so well. I met him, and I turned to him and I said, "You know, let's call him Mr. Phillips. So I said, Mr. Phillips. What a fascinating life you lead, I mean. The excitement and the influence, I mean, what does it feel like? This man stopped dead in his tracks, looks me deep in the eyes, and says, what do I feel like, Rabbi? I feel lonely. And I looked at him in shock. Lonely? I mean, you have to understand, this is a man who's never alone. Lonely? He said, Rabbi, I want you to understand something. I know that if I were to lose all of my money, nobody would give me the time of day. Now, this is a man who's lost in his character. His whole self-worth is so bound up with the character playing Mr. Millionaire that he doesn't believe that there's any real worth to himself if he weren't playing that character. That's a person lost in their role. That's like an actor who at the end of the film thinks he's dead. But the truth is, you get another role. And the truth is, think about it in your own life. How many times have you died already? Not you, soul. But how many times has your character died? I mean, not so long ago, I was visiting in Toronto and I went to see where I grew up. I went to my public school and suddenly I was bombarded with all these memories. I remember that time I was playing in the schoolyard and I beat up little Sally. Yeah, I was a little vicious little kid. Okay. No true confessions here. But anyways, and I suddenly was bombarded with such, and yet, who was that little redheaded boy? There is this incredible experience of a self that continues to exist, continues to be stable. I am. And yet, I am no longer that little boy. And yet, I visited my high school, and once again, I was bombarded, and yet, who I played, the role I played as a high school teenager. How many times, how many roles, how many characters have you been through already? But sometimes people get lost in their character. Sometimes people get locked, imprisoned in their character. And they can't grow. They can't change. They can't evolve. Because they still think that they're still that little boy that everybody picked on. And now he's a victim and sees every life situation as if everybody's trying to pick on him. Or now he's locked into who he was as a teenager. This is a person who's lost in their character. The Kabbalah teaches us an amazing idea. True growth happens when you're willing to let your character die. Imagine a seed, in order to become a tree, has to die as a seed to become a tree. And so too, in a little way, we have to let go of previous characters that may no longer be the script that we need to be playing. Because there's really only one actor, the soul, you. But we do play a number of characters in this life. And in fact, the Kabbalah reveals that we do play other characters in previous lives and in future lives. But what happens when a person gets lost in their character? I remember the actor Kirk Douglas once shared with me that very often people come up to him on the street and say, Kirk, you were amazing. You just lost yourself in Spartacus. You just became Mickey Marcus. So Kirk would respond, I didn't lose myself in the character. I can't afford to lose myself in the character because I have to be in my character and yet kind of outside looking at my character simultaneously because I also have to have my eye on the director and land in front of the frame of the camera. So Kirk shared with me, you see, actors can't get lost in their character. So he says, so Rabbi, really, this is a life lesson you're sharing. Just as an actor can't get lost in his character, we as souls can't get lost in our character. We have to kind of be in our character and yet kind of outside of our character, participating yet observing at the same time. In fact, he shared a cute little story. He said that when he was aspiring, he shared with me a cute story that he heard that the part for Vincent van Gogh was available. And this really excited him because until now, till that point, Kirk had played Mr. Macho, criminals, fighters. But now there's an opportunity to play a sensitive, struggling artist. And that really excited him as an actor because he wanted to play a part that was out of character relative to the characters he had played until that point. So Kirk was very excited about the opportunity. And in fact, he auditioned for the part, and he was thrilled. He got the part. Well, when the news broke in Hollywood, Kirk gets a call from his old buddy, John Wayne. And if you remember, John Wayne played cowboy. Well, so John calls up Kirk and says, "Kirk, what's this I hear about you? Is this true? Did you really take the part Vincent van Gogh? I mean, Kirk, what's a cowboy like you taking a sissy part like this?" Well, Kirk responded, John, we're not cowboys, John. We're actors." And therefore, Kirk said, you know, John, he was lost in the part of being a cowboy. He was an actor, but an actor that could only play a cowboy. A true actor should be able to play any part. A true actor is able to play any part and never get lost in any part, any one part. And so, too, the Kabbalah teaches us that we are souls and we come into this world to play a part, to play a character, to play a role. But we can never get confused. Don't ever confuse you as a soul with the persona that you play, with the role that you play. What happens when a person gets lost in their part and they look for themselves? How does one find themselves? Well, sometimes when we get lost in our part, God does us a big favor. He gives us a gift. The gift is called identity crisis. It's really an opportunity. Identity crisis can be the most powerful transformational opportunity in your life. Let me give you an example. One of my students, we'll call him Sam, was a very successful basketball player in Europe, playing professional basketball. And, well, one of the games, Sam, you have to understand, basketball was not only his game, basketball was his name, it was his life. His clothing, his friends, the place he hung out with, his entire identity, his entire sense of self-worth was bound up with Sam, the basketball man. Well, during one of the games, Sam goes up for the shoot, and he comes down on his ankle, rips his ligaments in the worst way. Well, they rush off onto the court and schlep him off the court. Schlep is a technical basketball term. Just joking. Schlep him off the court. Coach rushes to a star player, looks at the injury. Of course, Sam says, in excruciating pain, "Coach, I'm going to be okay. Coach, I'll work hard. I'll do physiotherapy. I'll be fine. I'll be up for the next season." Coach looks at Sam. So, Sam, I'm sorry, Sam, but this is more than just a small sprain, Sam. I've been in basketball long enough to know, Sam, this is an injury that, with all the therapy you'll do, you're not going to be able to play pro again. Imagine devastated. Imagine at that moment Sam died on the court that day. Not Sam, the soul. Sam, the basketball man, died that day. And now the soul, playing that role, has an opportunity. You see, Sam could have done what a lot of people do. Run away from the pain. He could have immersed himself in all kinds of forms of distraction from the devastating truth that he's no longer a basketball man. He could have turned to drugs. He could have turned to alcohol. He could have turned to all forms of trying to forget himself. But Sam discovered himself that day. Because on that day, the basketball man died. But on that day, the soul emerged to a whole new level. Because Sam made a very powerful decision. He decided that if I'm not going to play the basketball man, then who am I really? So Sam decided to take a spiritual journey. He came to Jerusalem. In fact, Sam decided to take one of our seminars, Israelite. And he turned his identity crisis into a whole new spiritual renewal. Very powerful teaching. Very, very powerful teaching. When you as a soul get lost in your character, when you confuse yourself to think that you are your body, or you are your talents, or you are your beauty, or you are your wisdom, you're setting yourself up for devastation. Yes, I play a rabbi, an author, but who knows how long the great director, the ultimate producer, will want me to play that role. But if I allow myself to get stuck in the role, and if I see my self-worth dependent upon my role, a role that surely will not go on forever, then I am connecting myself to that which is transient. I am embracing a life of insecurity. I am banking off of that which will die. And I'm turning my lifestyle into a death style. Because my whole self-worth is bound up with that about me, which is not eternal. That about me that is definitely transient. And that is really the choice of our lives. We play a role, but we are a soul. And we can't ever get lost in our role. Can you remember a time where perhaps you lost your cool, maybe found yourself yelling? Found yourself yelling. Interesting. Do you recall how you actually were in the anger and yet kind of watching yourself? Do you recall maybe like a little voice going off like, oh man, I'm going to really regret this. I can't believe I lost myself. Where did you lose yourself? You lost yourself into the moment, into the character, into the scene, into the drama. And you weren't able to be on top of it, a little bit transcendent of it. But isn't that an amazing experience how you can be both in the scene and yet outside it, both a participant and an observer? The power of the soul. You are a soul. Or do you recall perhaps falling into a deep state of sadness, maybe even depression? And yet in the midst of your darkness, do you recall yet somehow being outside of it, kind of looking at it? Do you recall perhaps where you say to yourself, you know I'm going to get through this. I know it's going to be okay. That is a soul moment. We are souls, and we come into this world to play a role. But don't become your role. Don't get lost in your role. What then is the source of our real sense of self? What then really is the source of our self-worth? Is it our bodies? Is it our talents? A friend of mine had a picture of an old, decrepitated woman on his desk. So I asked him, I said, is this your grandmother? He said, no. Is this your aunt? No. Well, who is this woman? Why is she on your desk? Oh, no, I'm not related to it at all. Well, who is she? She's Miss America 1909. I said, Miss America 1909? I mean, why do you have a picture of Miss America 1909? I mean, I can understand if you had a picture of Miss America 1909, with the way she looked 1909. But why do you have a picture of Miss America 1909, the way she looks in the 2000s? He said, because I like to remind myself, boy, she must have thought she was hot in 1909. I find it very humbling, he said. I understood the point. You see, if you think it's your looks that is a source of your self-worth, well, what happens when those wrinkles start appearing on your face? You see, souls are always young, but bodies are not always young. So if my whole self-worth is being drawn from my physical self, my physical persona, to be more correct, then I'm connecting myself to that which is really quite insecure. And what about my talents? I mean, imagine a fellow who is the best accountant in New York City. One day they call him up and his boss tells him, Jerry, we've got some sad news, but the company's letting you go. Company's letting me go. What do you mean? I'm the best accountant in New York City. How could you let me go? Well, we've got a replacement. Who could be replacing me? And suddenly the boss puts on the desk this tiny computer, pushes a button. Good morning. Pushes another button. All the records of the company zooming across the screen. I mean, this accountant can't compete with this computer. I mean, what happened to Jerry? Suddenly, he dies that moment. He's no longer Jerry the accountant. Well, again, Jerry has a choice. Are you a soul or are you an accountant? If you're a soul, then you'll realize, then this is an opportunity for me to play another role, to do other things. Now, I know that's challenging. I know that's challenging to all of us, but this is the path to true freedom. This is the path to true happiness. This is the path to real inner peace. Because real inner peace is when you find the real inner you and make peace with the fact that you are not your persona, you are not your character, you are not your role, you are not your body. What happens when suddenly you discover that your spouse is cheating on you? Suddenly your spouse has decided to go for someone else. What happens if your whole self-worth was bound up with that spouse? Now, granted, nobody would take that well. For sure not. But how could you survive that kind of pain? It's when you realize that you are a soul. You've come into this world to play a role, and that role can change, and that role probably will change. But be anchored in your inner self. But so often people look for the externalities to feel good about themselves, which actually turns into a distraction from their real selves, from their true selves. I remember I was at a event called USA 2000, 2000 singles. They asked me to come speak on love and relationships. At this event, I noticed that everyone seemed to have like kind of a tic. It was really strange. I thought, is this possibly like a singles disease? But really, it was people looking each other up and down. Of course, with me, it looked like a tic because I'm a short guy, so the journey was kind of not very long from up and down. But anyways, so here I am, this married rabbi, in a convention of 2,000 singles. And I'm standing beside this woman. This woman was dressed to kill, or actually, to be more correct, she was kind of undressed to kill. And this woman turns to me. She says, Rabbi, I am so tired of men looking at me like a piece of meat. I'm thinking to myself, well, why does she dress that way? I mean, what do you want, lady? But okay, I turned to her and I said, you know what? You know what happens at these events, unfortunately, is people get caught up with the packaging and can't see into the real content. You know, like people looking for someone who is more successful. I want you to know there will always be someone even more successful. And people looking for someone who's really beautiful or handsome. And I want you to know there will always be somebody more beautiful, more handsome. People looking for someone with a great sense of humor. And I want you to know for sure there will always be someone with an even better sense of humor. These are people who are looking for a persona partner, but not a soulmate. When you really look for a soulmate, then you know that there is no soul that is ever more or less than any other soul. You know that every single soul is unique, and there'll never be a more you. But when people confuse themselves and try to even market themselves, so people should think that I'm so brilliant and I'm so funny and I'm so successful and I'm so beautiful, I'm so handsome. But the truth is that none of that can be depended upon. I know men who've married some very attractive women in a very short amount of time. They weren't so attractive, started putting on weight. I know women who've married some very successful men. And within a short amount of time, these men have gone bankrupt. Well, what are you looking for? A persona partner or a soulmate? And what are you showing people? Your persona or your soul? Your character or who you really are? Are you trying to impress them with the role you've been given or with the soul that you are? This is really what it's all about. The secret to success in everything in your life, love, happiness, creativity, is you. But in order for you to be you, you need to be able to understand the difference between soul and the role that you play in this world. And so often, people get lost in their part. So often, people think that if they had a better part, they'd be more radiant. And I remember I was on a plane and I was flipping through a magazine. And I saw a very somewhat amusing ad, an ad for plastic surgery, but not just an ad for plastic surgery, but it actually listed all the things you could do and how much it would cost. So you could get your ears higher, your eyebrows more pointy, your nose smaller, your chin with a cleft. In fact, you could get a bigger tuchus, a bigger rear end. I'm thinking to myself, like, what's wrong with the one I have? I mean, what do I need a big rear end for? Am I afraid that someone might bump into me from behind? I mean, like a fender? I could, you know, fatter lips. I mean, why would anybody want fatter lips? You know how they make fatter lips? They inject cells from cadavers, from dead bodies. Yes, if you look at your license, there's actually a little place that you can sign over whether you want to contribute your dead cells for fat lips. I'm just joking. But imagine fat lips. I mean, why would anybody want to kiss a person with that kind of a lips? I mean, I call that the original kiss of death. And yet I went through this list and decided, well, gee, I wonder what it would take to create a new David Aaron. So I took out my little calculator and I figured out, and by the way, there was a nice credit card layaway plan that I could, in easy bites, I could change my whole appearance. And it wasn't so bad, you know. It wasn't, you know, it didn't cost an arm and a leg. Just joking. But really, who are you? Because if you invest yourself in that which is not eternal, in that which is transient, in that which will not last. Now, don't get me wrong. Of course, an actor embraces with love the character that he plays. But he can never get lost in his character. Never think he is his character, but rather always know that he's come into this world to play a part. And when you play your part, you discover how whole you really are. In our next talk, we will explore making eye contact, discovering the supreme universal self, the ultimate I.
Making eye contact, discovering the supreme universal self. To get in touch with our I as distinct from our me, we must disengage our inner self from its outer trappings and make the ultimate I, God, the source of our self-worth. This spiritual transformation energizes us with incredible life force and awareness. It empowers us to experience how each and every one of us is an individualized expression of God, a unique channel for divine presence into this world. This is our service, our purpose, and our ultimate joy. All success flows from our connection to God, relationships, work, and creativity.
A number of years ago, I was in Detroit, and I was raising funds for my some of my projects. And I was very lucky to have a meeting with a very philanthropic woman. A friend of a friend introduced me, and this woman kindly offered to take me out to lunch. Well, during lunch, she was there with her daughter-in-law, and she turned to me and she said, "Well, okay, tell me what you do." Well, I didn't feel so invited, but okay. So I took out of my briefcase a brochure that I had worked on for many months, and she held the brochure as if it was a piece of dirty toilet paper with her fingers and said, "Oh, I've seen thousands of these. Just tell me what you do." And so I began to tell her some of the projects that I'm involved in. And as I'm speaking, she dramatically takes out of her bag her checkbook and her pen, and she begins to write a check. She turns to her daughter-in-law and says, "I don't know why I'm doing this, but anyways," and she writes a check. Now, in the world of fundraising, it's known you never look at the check. You simply fold the check and you put it in your pocket. And from the deepest place in your heart, you thank the person. And then you go to the bathroom and check how much it is. I'm just joking. But anyways, I figured, okay, that wasn't so successful. She wrote an $18 check, which was, you know, nice, but not what I hoped to achieve, and certainly not what could really fuel the project that I was soliciting her for. Well, to my absolute surprise, I get a phone call the next day, and she invites me to do a parlor meeting at her home next week, and she will invite all her friends to her home, which is really a mansion. Wow, I couldn't believe it. I'm so, so thankful. Well, so I get to the home, and it was quite a exquisite architecture, and go inside, and I see, wow, it's catered with the waitresses and with white gloves and wine, and wow, I'm thinking, my gosh, imagine what must cost them for this spread. And her husband came out and welcomed me. The host of the home was very kind, and I was surely hoping that he'd be excited about what I share at his home and perhaps really get behind some of my projects. Well, I began to – they pulled everyone together to sit down, and I began to share some of my thoughts. And the host of the home, who I'm most interested in reaching, he just gets up and leaves. I was shocked. What did I say wrong? And what could I have said that put him off? And he leaves the room. Then he comes back and he stands at the doorway. And then he leaves again. And then he comes back and he sits at the back. And I couldn't figure what was going on. Well, I figured I must have blown that, and somehow I wasn't communicating as best as I should or could. After my talk, people kind of gathered around me and asked me some questions, and suddenly my host barges into the middle of the circle with the brochure of my organization and a check sticking out of it, and he says very loudly, "Rabbi, here is my donation." And I thought, well, okay, I guess, you know, it was a little dramatic, but I suppose he was just trying to get the ball rolling. Well, after my discussion with those around me, the conversation kind of went off into different directions, and I overheard a conversation with a number of people speaking to my host, and they said, "Hey, George, we understand that you just built a new swimming pool." I said, "Oh, yes, yes, yes." "Well, tell me, George, what did it cost? It's quite something." "Oh, my gosh," he says. "You know, I figured out that if I swim in it every single day for the next 10 years, and I figured out how many strokes I would make in a day, it would cost me about $1 a stroke." Now, everyone kind of laughed, but he didn't seem to be joking. He actually tried to figure out what each stroke might cost him. Well, bizarre. As I was leaving and driving away with my friend, it started to pour rain. As we're driving out of the driveway, I notice, looking out the rear view window, that my host stomps out of his house and starts walking down the street in the pouring rain. He has no coat. He has no umbrella. My friend, who actually knows this family, turns to me and says, "Poor fellow." I said, "Poor fellow? I mean, this guy's a multimillionaire. What kind of poor fellow is he?" He says, "Didn't you see that he couldn't sit for a moment during your talk?" I just thought I wasn't interesting him. "No, I've been in many events. This man can't sit for a moment. I mean, look at him right now. It's known he walks the streets at night. Everybody knows he can't sleep. Poor soul." Poor soul. Yes, in fact, in many years of my career as an educator, I've met many poor souls that live in million-dollar homes. Who are we? What is really the source of our self-worth? We discussed in the last talk how there's the me and then there's the self. You are a soul. And as a soul, you come into this world to play a role. But you have to always remember, don't ever confuse who you are with what you've come to do. And very often people get lost. People get lost in their role. People begin to somehow become controlled by their role. People begin to see their character, their talents, their financial successes, their physical beauty or physical strength as the source of their self-worth. But all that is transient. All that is here today and may be gone tomorrow. In fact, I saw a cute little film about hair loss called "Hair Today, Gone Tomorrow." The self is the soul. But who is the soul? Who really is the self? Well, the Kabbalah teaches us that the self is a spark of the divine, an aspect of the divine. As I mentioned in our first talk, God is not a being floating in outer space over there, but rather God is the ultimate timeless reality wherein which you and I exist. And that really, if God were the sun, we would be rays of light emanating from the sun. Of course, the difference in this metaphor is whereby the rays of the sun emerge outside of the sun. The Kabbalah teaches us that we are like rays in the sun, however, that continue to exist within the sun. So we discussed how the divine God is the ultimate all-embracing reality wherein which we exist, that God is like the thinker and we are like the thought, and the thought exists within the mind of the thinker, and the thought is an expression of the thinker. And so, too, the soul is a ray of light, divine light. I mean, think about it. Are you self-sufficient? Are you self-defined? The truth is, the Kabbalah teaches us that God is self-evident, that you don't need to prove the existence of God, just as you don't need to prove your own existence. You know you exist because you know you exist. And just as it is self-evident that I exist, it is self-evident that I do not exist independently. It is self-evident that I am not self-sustained. It is self-evident that I am not self-evident. I don't have to exist. And I'm not in control of whether I will exist or not exist. This is a very deep, deep teaching that the Kabbalah reveals about the true self. The true self, you, are an expression of the divine. You are a ray of divine light. The self didn't give birth to itself, and the self doesn't and can't terminate the self. In fact, think about this. Right now you're thinking, so let's just do a little experiment. If you are the master of thinking, well then, I ask you to stop thinking just for 10 seconds. Let's all just stop thinking for 10 seconds. The truth is, we can't stop thinking. We could stop thinking about this and start thinking about that, but thinking? We're always thinking. We really have no choice in the matter of thinking. Well, if that's true, then are we really the masters of thinking? Are we the source of thought? Or are we being fueled with thinking? And our choice is what to think, but our choice is not that we think. We're always thinking. What about feeling? Are we the master of feelings? Well, let's do a little experiment. Let's stop feeling for 10 seconds. The truth is that we really can't stop feeling. We're always feeling. We might have a choice what to feel, but we don't have a choice that we feel. We're always feeling something. So are we the master of feeling? Or is feeling pouring into us? Is feeling pouring through us, and we somewhat like a channel or a pipe can determine where to direct those feelings? But we are not the source of feelings. And what about our life in general? Are we the source of life? We are alive, but are we life itself? I mean, are we the master of life? If we are, then let's do a little experiment. I'm going to ask you all to now just stop beating your heart for just 10 seconds. Now, I did this experiment and someone took this seriously, so I'm just joking. But, I mean, can you stop beating your heart and start it up again? Well, if not, then who's really beating your heart? Who's determining that the beat goes on? The truth is that you and I are a manifestation of the divine, but we are not the divine. There is the me, the character that I play. There is the self, the soul. But who is the master self? Who is the master soul? Who is the soul of all souls that each and every one of us is a ray of, an expression of? Whoever that soul of souls is who we call God, or the truth is Jewish tradition calls Adonai, which literally means my master self, the master soul. This is a phenomenal, empowering realization that you and I do not exist independent of a higher power, an ultimate self, and each and every one of us are connected to that ultimate self. And the question is, do we know it, and do we live that truth, and do we experience the joy of that amazing mystery? In fact, really what's going on here is a partnership. God provides the substance, and we determine the form. You know, Aristotle, the great philosopher, he presented a distinction of form and substance. Everything has substance, and then there's determined what is the form. So the table is made of wood, but it's in the form of a table. That wood could be in the form of a chair. The substance of our lives, the substance called thinking, feeling, living, we are not the masters of the substance. But the form that we've been given a share in determining, and that is our constant partnership with God, the ultimate self, the source of all consciousness, the source of all life, the context and ground and essence of all consciousness and all life. Imagine, right this very second, in order for me to just speak, there has to be perfect coordination of 17 muscles in my face. Every syllable that comes out of my mouth is perfect coordination. But am I coordinating those muscles? Do I even know how to speak? Did I teach myself to speak? The wisdom that enables me to speak, is that my wisdom? And the wisdom that enables you to hear, is that your wisdom? Or are we actually tapping into a wisdom greater than ourselves? In fact, what the Kabbalah reveals to us is that the powers within us are not of us and not from us. And that everything we do, we cannot do alone. Everything we do is a partnership with the Master Self, a partnership with Adonai, a partnership with God. And yet sometimes we do things that God doesn't want us to do. And in that way, we violate that partnership. God entrusts us with the substance of thinking, feeling, living. And we give it a shape, we give it a form, we direct it to that which is really against life, against wisdom, against truth. But really what the Kabbalah teaches us is that as rays of light, for that ultimate light, we are a channel, we are a vehicle for the manifestation, a channel for the presence of the divine into the world. And that is our connection. As I've mentioned already a number of times, God is not a being floating in outer space over there. You will not meet God in outer space, but rather you meet God in inner space. And when a person comes to truly realize and experience who they are, they will immediately experience God. Not that they will think they are God, but they will know that they are rooted in God. And everything that they are can only be because they are an expression of God. In fact, the Bible teaches when Moses says to God, "What is your name?" God says, "I am that I am." Only God can say, "I am that I am. I am the source of myself." But mankind cannot say, you cannot say, "I am that I am." You can only say, "I am that God is. I am not the source of my existence. I did not give birth to myself. I did not teach myself to think. I did not teach myself to feel. I am not the source, and I'm not the master of feeling and thinking. But I am a partner. And as a partner, I participate in giving thought its form. I choose what to think, not that I think. I choose what to feel, not that I feel. I choose how to live my life. But I don't choose that I am alive at all. When the Jewish people heard the voice of God at Sinai over 3,000 years ago, what did they hear? What was the first statement at Mount Sinai? The famous 10 commandments. What was really the first commandment? See, most people think that a prophet is someone who hears a voice booming from heaven. But that's not really true. That's not really the experience of the prophet. In fact, Imagine the audition for the God voice in the Ten Commandments. I remember the first time I heard God's voice, it was when I saw the Ten Commandments. Imagine the audition, right? A young actor comes in, they give him the part. I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt. Oh, man, who is this guy? Mickey Mouse? Throw him out of here. He's not a God voice. Next person comes in. Oh, we're sorry, ma'am. This is a God voice. Next fellow walks in.
I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt.
Oh, that's a used car salesman. We want a God voice. Now comes in an actor.
I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt.
Now that's a God voice. Loud, booming. And of course, God is from England. Who determined the God voice? What is a God voice? The God voice is actually an inner voice that the entire nation of Israel heard. And that you and I can also open our channels to hear. God is not a being floating in outer space over there. And the communication is not through outer space, but the communication is inner space. The individual, you, is an individualized expression of the universal self, God. I am not God and you are not God, but we are expressions. We are rays of divine light. When the nation of Israel heard the voice at Sinai, what did they hear? What did the Israelites hear at Sinai? I am God, your God, who took you out of Egypt. Well, that's not really what they heard, because that's English. And as I've mentioned before, the Bible, the Torah, is written in Hebrew. Rather, they heard, Anochi Hashem Elokecha asher hotziticha me'eretz Mitzrayim. Now, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, that Hebrew could be translated as, I am God, your God, who took you out of Egypt. But it could also be translated as, I is God, your God, who took you out of Egypt. Now, what's the difference other than poor grammar? The difference or the nuance that I want you to understand here is that the Israelites at Sinai encountered the great I, the ultimate I am God, your God, who took you out of Egypt. What does this mean, I am God, your God, who took you out of Egypt? I mean, the Israelites got out of Egypt only about 50 days ago. How could I not who you are? Imagine someone saves your life and then calls you up only maybe a month and a half later and calls you up and says, hi, this is Jack. You remember, you know, Jack? Oh, Jack who? Jack who? Jack, you know, Jack who saved you, who pulled you out of the swimming pool when you were drowning? I mean, of course you know who Jack is. I mean, you decided to name all your children after Jack, right? Jack, Jackie, Jacuzzi. I mean, you know, like, of course you know who Jack is. What does it mean, I am God, your God, who took you out of Egypt? That was not what they heard. That's not the meaning of what they heard. What they heard was, I am is the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt. The Lord your God is the I am. And when you realize that, you tap into the source of getting out of Egypt, getting out of slavery, liberating yourself from the confines of not only slavery of other people, but slavery to your persona, to your character, to your situation. When you realize that your I is a little I, tapped into an expression, a ray of the great I. I mentioned in our first talk that the name for the divine in the Torah is Yud He Vav He, which suggests Havaya, reality. Haya, Hoveh, Yeh, was, is, and always will be, the ultimate timeless reality. But that word Yud, He, Vav, He is also connected to the verb to be. To be. And that really, perhaps the best English translation of the word in Torah tradition that suggests the divine would not be God, but the Be-er. The be-er is the source of being. Yud-he-vav-he, also suggests the source of all being, the one who's causing all to be. So imagine if you see someone singing, they'd be called a singer. Someone dancing, they'd be called a dancer. But what about the one who is being? Being is a verb. And you and I are actually a verb. We are human beings. You thought you were a noun, but you're not. You're a verb. Right? We're beings. But who is the source of all being? Who is the beer? So if you're singing, you're a singer. If you're dancing, you're a dancer. If you're being the source of all being, then you are a beer. In other words, if God were a dancer, we would be his dancing. If God were a singer, we would be his singing, his song. In fact, the word Israel in Hebrew, the Kabbalists play this game called Scrabble. They like to scrabble the Hebrew letters. The word Israel has hidden in it the word Shir El, which means the song of God. This is the message of Israel, that we, in all of us, the whole world, is the song of God. He is the singer, and we are the singing. He is the beer, and we are the being. Now, I felt a little excited about this discovery I made when I realized that the best translation of the word that suggests divinity in the Torah is the beer. And I taught this truth as I perceived it for many years. And then one of my students said, you know, Rabbi, you didn't make up that word, did you? I said, well, I think I did. He said, no, that word is actually in the dictionary. That's a real word. I said, yeah, I know, right. And no, really, look in the Oxford Unabridged Dictionary and you'll find that word. Well, so I anxiously went and found myself an unabridged dictionary, big fat book, and sure enough, I found the word beer. And the definition is an alcoholic drink. But just underneath that is the word beer. And the dictionary describes it as the self-existent, the great I am. Fascinating. It also says that it was a rare word. So in fact, we don't believe in God, some being floating in over space over there, creating us over here. But rather, we believe in the beer. And we as his beings, manifestations of himself, are connected. He is the ultimate I, and we are a ray of himself. Fascinating. What an idea, personally transforming, when you experience this truth and you realize if a person is funny but they're not being funny, then they're not expressing or manifesting their funniness. If a person is intelligent and they're not being intelligent, then they're not expressing their intelligence. But if a person is intelligent and they are being intelligent, then they are expressing their intelligence. We are a divine being, an expression of the divine beer, the great I am, the self-existent. We are not self-existent. We are not the great I am. But when we say I am, we draw that power from the great I am. And when we realize that partnership, when we realize that connection, when we realize that he is the singer and we are the song, we discover the true value of our inner self. The prophet does not hear a voice booming from outer space, but hears an inner voice that he knows is not his own. He knows that did not emerge from him, but a voice that pierces deep, deep down through him. Shattering through him. Very powerful. There are times that Moses actually speaks, and it is the divine speaking through him. There are many verses in the Torah, in the Bible, whereby Moses is no longer Moses. He's simply a channel, a vehicle for this greater self. To get a glimpse of this experience, think of artists. Perhaps you are an artist. Perhaps you've experienced this. Very often, artists describe how they sit in front of their easel and canvas and feel this incredible sense of insecurity. I mean, how can I do it again? They look at their room filled with these beautiful paintings, and yet they realize in some way, this is not me. I didn't do this. And yet they somehow have to just start. So they put their paintbrush on the canvas, and one stroke, two strokes, and suddenly they just feel literally possessed. I've myself had that experience. I'm not an artist, but I am a musician. I recall one day I was sitting by my piano, kind of just fiddling around. I don't know why you'd fiddle around on a piano, but okay, I was pianoing around. And suddenly I felt guided. My fingers went to different notes, and a melody came out of me. My wife came out of the kitchen, and she said, "What is that?" And I said, "I don't know. I'm just trying to get out of the way and just let it come through me." These are moments that musicians have experienced, that creative moment whereby you know it's not you, although you know it's somehow coming through you. Very powerful experience. There are artists that I've met who literally feel uncomfortable signing their names to their work because they know it's not them. They know it's not their work. It's a humbling experience. Suddenly you experience yourself not as the painter, but as the paintbrush or even the painting. Nietzsche, the famous German philosopher, known for that famous slogan, that famous statement, "God is dead." I actually learned that philosophy that in the bathroom. It was written on the bathroom wall. It said, "God is dead, Nietzsche." And then underneath that it said, "Nietzsche is dead, God." That was my graffiti philosophy course. But anyways, although Nietzsche was quite well known for saying that God is dead, he's not as well known for another thing he said. He's not as well known for another truth that he expressed. Nietzsche said that unless a person experiences an infinite whole working through them, their life has no meaning. Now, what is Nietzsche talking about? Who is this, or what is this infinite whole working through you? You see, Nietzsche didn't believe in God, and neither do I, and neither does Kabbalah, and neither does the Torah. But the Torah, the Kabbalah, teach us that there is no being floating in outer space, but rather we are connected to the source of all being in inner space. And that the great I am is not you and I, but we are an expression of that great I am. And when we have those moments of inspiration, those moments where we feel possessed by a creative spirit that moves through us, this is a moment of true humble service. To serve is the greatest self-serving experience. When we are serving that source of life, when we are serving God as a vehicle, as a channel for His wisdom in the world, for His love in the world, we didn't create love. We're not the source of love. We didn't teach everyone in the world to recognize it, to want it, to need it. Well, then who did? Whoever did is who we call God, or actually who we call Adonai, the master self, the source of all of us, the ground and root and context of all of us. And our greatest joy is to be in service. This is really the source of self-worth. When a person makes their character the source of their self-worth, then they're investing and connecting to that which is transient. But when a person finds their self-worth in the source of all self, in God, and seek to be in service as a channel for God's wisdom, for God's love, for God's vitality into the world, of course, through their role as a character, then they have found the ultimate experience. However, the Kabbalah teaches us that sometimes the soul goes into exile. The great prophet Yechezkel said, "I am in the exile," But the Kabbalah, the Zohar, the classic teaching of the Zohar, the classic teaching of the Kabbalah tells us that when Yechezkel says, I am in the exile, his I is not only referring to his individual I, but he's referring to the divine. That God is also speaking through Yechezkel, saying, I am in the exile. And rather, the Kabbalah teaches us that we need to reclaim our I, take our I out of exile, and direct our I, direct our self, our individual self, to the universal self, to God. And so people get lost in their character, lost in their money, lost in their talents, lost in the part that they're playing right now. But to be liberated, we need to hear, I am, is God your God, who takes you out of Egypt, who empowers you to know the true source of who you are and why you are. I read a chilling story in Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. Viktor Frankl, the founder of logotherapy, explains that he, as a Jew, was rounded up by the Nazis in his community, taken to a concentration camp. They got into the room, and the Nazi officer turned to all the Jews and said, strip and throw everything that you have into the center of the room, and you have 20 seconds or we will kill you. Viktor Frankl, as everyone else began to rip off their clothing and throw it into the center, but Viktor Frankl was holding on to his briefcase with his years and years of research in psychology. He runs up to the Nazi officer and he says, sir, excuse me, I've thrown everything into the pile, but I'm just holding on to these meaningless pieces of paper. It's just some research that I have, and it certainly would have no value to you. And the Nazi officer was listening as if sympathetic. And then he turns to him and says, throw it into the pile, I will shoot you. Viktor Frankl describes how he threw his life's work into the center of the room, stripped of everything. Well, the Nazis began to distribute to these prisoners garbs of the concentration camp. And Viktor Frankl describes how he walked out of that room. And he just kind of put his hands into the pockets of these ragged garments that he knew some poor other prisoner wore and is no longer alive. Yet Viktor Frankl suddenly feels in the pocket a little piece of paper. So he reaches in, pulls out this little piece of paper, and he sees there was a page ripped out of a prayer book. And what was it? It was the Shema, the famous central meditation and declaration of the Jewish people. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, Israel, God our God, God is one. And Viktor Frankl says, I threw everything in the pile. I stripped myself a naked soul, and God gave me his oneness, the Shema. This is the path of liberation. The story, in a strange way, a prisoner of a concentration camp, is a story of the liberation of soul, of the reclaiming of soul. Because sometimes when life situation strips you of your role, of your persona garments, that can be an amazing moment to remember, I'm a soul anchored in the soul of all souls. I'm a soul anchored in the universal soul. The Be'er is my source, and I am his being. There's a very famous verse in the Psalms of David. He teaches, if I ascend to heaven, you are there. And if I descend to hell, you are there also with me. Fascinating. What is he teaching us? The great Hasidic master, the Rebbe of Lublin, Rav Tzadok, explains that the truth is that whether you're in heaven or hell, God is with you, because God is always with you. How can the sun not always be with his ray? So then why are you in hell? Because you forgot that truth. Because you lived a life in denial. You lived your life deluding yourself that you are self-defined, that you are self-sustaining, that somehow you are the master of life rather than a channel for life, rather than a junior partner in giving life its form. This is really the choice. This is the choice of our lives. It's called identity. What do you or who do you identify with? Do you identify with your role, with your character, with your money, with your property, with your body? Or do you embrace your money, your property, your body? It's part of your role. It's part of the character you're here to play. But you know that's not your root. You know that's not your essence. And you identify with the source of all identity, the divine. The self is in a dilemma. Should it identify with the me, the character, or does it identify with the I, the ultimate I, the source of all life, the source of all creativity? That really is the choice. Sometimes the soul gets lost and is exiled and displaced from consciously being connected to God as the soul's context, God as the soul's soul in essence. And this becomes deeply painful. Deeply, deeply painful. And sometimes physical pain, sometimes even manifestation of disease happens because we become so trapped in our physical garments that God is trying to free us so that we disidentify, a little bit disidentify with our bodies. And when a person's in pain, in a certain way, they really have no choice. They have to somehow say, I'm not my body. They have to somehow say, I'm not this pain. Well, then who am I? And this becomes an opportunity for a release, a liberation, a getting out of our personal Egypt, our personal slavery, and a connection to the ultimate, to the self. And one of the empowering techniques for doing this is, in fact, meditation. There is a great Hasidic Kabbalistic master referred to as the Piazetzner Rebbe, Rabbi Kalman Shapiro. And he taught his students a meditation called inner silence. In his meditation, he instructed the student close their eyes and watch their thoughts. As those thoughts run by your mind's eye, you realize how you are bombarded with thoughts. And the Piazetzner Rebbe explains that the difference between a sane person and an insane person is an insane person goes along with every thought. But a sane person can step back and observe the flow of thoughts. And you realize that I have thoughts, but I am not my thoughts. And the Piazetzner Rebbe explains that when a person gets to that place where they can observe their thoughts, they should then choose a verse from the Torah, from the Bible, and repeat it over and over again. A verse from the Bible, the words of God, the thoughts of God. And in so doing, they free themselves from the exile of thoughts and anchor themselves in the source of all thinking, the master of all thinking, God. And even just simple meditation, I often, at our Israelite retreats and seminars, have people close their eyes. There's a certain spiritual opportunity that happens when we close our eyes. Because Very often, we as seers become too identified with what we see, with what we feel. We feel anger, but we become our anger. We feel sad, but we become our sadness. But if we can step back and realize I'm not my sadness, I feel sad, but I'm not sad. I feel angry, but I'm not anger. I see colors, but I don't become the colors. There's a difference between the seer and the seen. And so when we close our eyes, there's a moment, an opportunity to step back a little bit and experience the seeing self, divorced from what it sees, and realizing that the seeing self is not the source, but rather a ray of light of the great seer, the source of all seeing. Now, there are certain traditions and techniques that relate to this very same idea of releasing the soul from the persona or from ego. But this is like getting out of Egypt, but then not getting to Sinai and receiving the word of God, the directives of God. This is like getting out of Egypt and not getting to the promised land. It's one thing to free yourself from oppression, but then it's another thing to free yourself to expression. And this is really the role of the commandments. When God says, I am the Lord your God, or actually, I am, is the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt, then God really provided us with a reason why we would follow his directives, his guidance, his commands. Because when I make my will, when I make God's will my will, I align my individual self with the universal self and become a vehicle for divine presence into the world. This is the commandment. This is the power of a life of commandments, the commandment-driven life, hearing. The commandment-driven life is a life whereby I understand that I am a master of my character by being a servant to God. And the more I am a servant to the ultimate self, the source of all wisdom, life, creativity, and the more I'm a vehicle, and the more I use my unique talents, my character, my role as the packaging for that content, the more I'm able to experience the true meaning and the true power of the individual self. Making eye contact is about disidentifying with that which is transient about us, our persona, our physical bodies, our material wealth, disidentifying with it and identifying with the source of all, which is God. We love our character, we love our role, but we can never forget that we are not our role. We must always remember that we are a soul, an expression of the soul of all souls, that our individual self is really an expression of a universal self, a self that was, is, and always will be. And when we live a life conscious of that truth, knowing that we're always connected, knowing that we don't have to do anything to earn our connection to God, but there's much that we can do to blind ourselves. There's much that we can do to cause ourselves to forget who we are and cause ourselves great distress and pain, confuse ourselves to think that we are self-defined, that we are self-sufficient, that we are self-sustaining, and that we all actually exist independent. This becomes our own source of suffering. I once heard it put so well. People are afraid that they will be punished for their sins. But we will not be punished for our sins. We are actually punished by our sins. Because sin means somehow to confuse ourselves to think that I exist independent of the divine and can just do whatever I want. That's like a song thinking it can do other than its singer, like a dance thinking it could do other than the dancer. But the joy of the song is to be the song. And the joy of ourselves is to be who we are and who we are. And who are we? We are a soul, a ray of divine light, a vehicle, a channel, in service of the universal self, the master of all life, Adonai. This is the power. This is the joy. This is the ecstasy. This is the true meaning of making eye contact. And when we're able to make eye contact, our individual eye with the great ultimate eye, we are empowered to learn how to make eye contact with everybody else. As we are taught, love your neighbor as yourself. I am God. Why does it say I am God? What does it have to do with love your neighbor as yourself? But when you realize that you are a ray of that great I, and that I am a ray of that great I, and he and she is a ray of that great I, then we realize that it is really only our bodies that are convincing us that we exist separate and independent of each other. Love your neighbor as yourself. I is God your God, is the reason why we should and why we can love our neighbor as ourself. Because our neighbor is one with ourself, and our neighbor and ourselves are one with the source of all self. And therefore we understand the commandment of the Torah, love your neighbor as yourself. How can you command me to love? Maybe I will, maybe I won't. We'll go out, we'll have a few drinks, and we'll see if we get along. No, we are commanded to love each other because we are one. And love is to behave in a manner that acknowledges that oneness. So if we're commanded to do something, it's because we absolutely can do something. Because we are commanded to simply act in a way that is in concert with who we are. I am one with you and you are one with me and we are one with all of mankind. And when we are commanded to love each other, then we're commanded to behave in a way that reveals that truth and enables us to experience the joy of that truth. And we are also commanded to love God. Now, how can I love God? Maybe I will, maybe I won't. He's so far away. He's up in heaven somewhere. How do I love God? Of course you can love God. The command to love God means to live a life, a lifestyle that enables you to experience this eternal truth that you are one with God right now. And there's nothing you can do that will ever change that truth, although there's much that you can do to cause yourself to forget that truth and turn away from that truth and confuse yourself and embrace a lie. Eye contact is the secret of the Kabbalah.
Please, God, use me. Secrets to Purposeful, Passionate Living. To serve or not to serve, that is the question. Most people think that God is somewhere up there. Therefore, to serve God seems to be about becoming weak and servile. But the truth is that service plugs our individual self into the supreme universal self, which is God. It doesn't diminish us, rather it intensifies us. In fact, service is the only key to a life filled with purpose, meaning, freedom, passion, power, and happiness. Our daily prayer should be, please God, use me. Make me into an instrument for your will, wisdom, and creativity. Let me delight in the joy of feeling connected to you, becoming resourceful and divinely useful.
The comedian Stephen Wright once said a cute line. When I turned 2, I was really anxious. Because I doubled my age in a year, I thought, if this keeps up, by the time I'm 6, I'll be 90. We human beings can often be very complex, anxious, and confused. Animals, on the other hand, they seem to kind of go with the flow. If you give them water, food, shelter, you don't hurt them, then animals are basically pretty happy creatures. But we human beings, we might have delicious food, fine wine, palatial shelter. We might be blessed with great health. And yet, you know, we still might not be happy. In fact, some of us might even be miserable. Why? Because we're not simply animals with greater intelligence. We're soul. And even if our bellies are full, we may still feel profoundly empty. In fact, having our bellies full and yet still feeling empty can be excruciatingly frustrating. We then feel not only sad, but guilty over our baseless sadness. We are blessed and yet we're depressed. Now we feel downright miserable. If we were to go back in time 100 years and describe to people then what life would look like in 100 years, they would be absolutely shocked. I mean, describe a modern kitchen, microwave oven, food processor, dishwasher. You're talking to people who are chopping wood to stoke a fire. Talk about transportation, the cars, and the luxuries that we have in our cars. Talk about communication, mobile phones, wireless internet. I remember when I was a kid watching the comedy show Get Smart, and Agent Smart had a shoe phone. And I remember thinking, wow, imagine if someday we would all have shoe phones. And you know what? I've exceeded my dream, because not only do I have a cell phone, but as a rabbi, you know, I wear a yarmulke, a skull cap, and it actually doubles as a satellite dish. Just joking. Are we the happiest generation in history? They would probably think so, but I wonder. In fact, we may be perhaps one of the most miserable generations in history. You know, if you've ever gone to the museum, you might notice that pagan man deified animals. The holy men would wear animal masks, and they would have little figures of animals. Why? Because they aspired to be like animals. Peaceful, natural, happy, guilt-free. Animals don't sit around and torment themselves with annoying philosophical questions about purpose and meaning. Give your dog Alpo and he's basically content. However, our problems are not solved by merely physical things. But there's a thirst inside us. I don't know if you ever had this experience, but there's times where I come home after a long day of work and I feel really hungry. I open up the refrigerator door and I kind of go through this regimen. Not the tofu burger. Not the tuna casserole. Not the cheese. And although my refrigerator is quite full, somehow nothing in there speaks to me. So I close the door. And then I come right back seconds later, open the door again, go through the same thing. Not the spaghetti from yesterday. Not the meatloaf from 3 years ago. And suddenly I say, no, I close the door. And then I come right back. Have you ever experienced yourself coming back and forth to the refrigerator, opening and closing, opening and closing? Why? Even when the refrigerator is filled, somehow we feel this hunger, and that's because what you're looking for is not in the refrigerator. What you're really looking for is in the freezer. It's Ben and Jerry's. I'm just joking. What you're really looking for is something for your soul, not just something for your stomach. And as the Torah and as the Bible teaches, man does not live on bread alone. Even when we have all the luxuries we could imagine, it might not be enough. I remember seeing a great bumper sticker. It said, "The best things in life are not things. Love is not a thing. Purpose is not a thing. Meaning is not a thing." Even if you have everything, you still may feel like nothing. because your life misses the no things. And I found after many, many years as a spiritual coach and educator that people have problems. And a problem, you can find maybe an answer. But a soul problem needs a solution, S-O-U-L, a solution. Because when we feel like our life doesn't matter, when we feel like we're insignificant, when we feel like we're not welcomed, when we feel like we don't belong or we're not loved, or we feel that we're not growing, even when we have everything, we still may feel like we are nothing. I've learned from the Kabbalah that we human beings have three fundamental needs. We all need to feel significant, acknowledged, valued. We all need to feel loved, included, welcomed, a sense of belonging. And we all need to feel that we're growing, evolving, advancing. But the question is, do we find a solution that truly satisfies that need? Or do we find some bogus way to give ourselves a quick fix? I find that very often we try to feel significant. So we figure if we look better, if we wear nicer clothing, then somehow we'll be more acknowledged, we'll be more valued. You talk about, she looks like $1 million. I can't understand why anybody would want to look like $1 million when $1 million are green. We try to be the best, the winner, perhaps get ourselves registered in some world-breaking record in McGuinness, be honored, award-winning, reach the top, maybe have fame. But is that really going to offer us the solution to wanting to feel significant? We want to feel loved, connected, accepted, welcomed, included. But then what we do is we try to find love and we confuse it with sex. We confuse feeling accepted with conformity. Or we hope that we'll feel included by being a fan of some baseball team or some other fan club, or we belong to some greater entity by walking down the street wearing Gap clothing. And growth. We all want to feel like we're growing, but do we substitute real growth for monetary growth, property evolving, promotion, getting ahead? The Kabbalah teaches us that the reason why we all need to feel significant, loved, and growing is because we are souls. And all we want to do as souls is be who we are. And what is a soul? We discussed in previous talks, a soul is who you are. You don't have a soul, you are a soul. And a soul is an aspect of the divine. A soul to God is like a ray of light to the sun. You are a soul. You are a ray of divine light. And therefore, it's natural. Of course, we want to feel significant because we are significant. How could a expression of divinity be anything less than divine? And we all want to feel loved. And of course we should feel loved. Because as an aspect of the divine, as a part of God, God loves us. And the Kabbalah teaches us that God loves us with the very same love that he loves himself. Because we are a part of him. A ray of divine light. And of course we need to grow and we want to grow because we've been put on earth to grow. That is our mission on earth. To rise to challenges, to make choices, and choose love over hatred, choose peace over war, choose kindness over cruelty. What motivates us is to be who we are. Psychology has deeply probed what motivates the human beings, and numerous thoughts have been advanced, and numerous ideas have been offered. We all know that Sigmund Freud thought that the fundamental motivating drive of the human being is sex. Alfred Adler, his thoughts is that social acceptance is at the core of what drives us. But the Kabbalah teaches us that what really drives us is the power called emunah. Emunah is a Hebrew word, and it's been loosely translated as faith. But I would contest that, because emunah is much deeper than the word faith. The word emunah comes from the Hebrew word ne'eman, which means faithful or dedicated. Also, the word is associated with the Hebrew word omanut, which means to be an artist. In the deepest sense, emunah means a dedication, a faithfulness to ourselves, a commitment to portraying who we are. Just as an artist portrays the abstract in concrete terms, so too the power of emunah is the power to be faithful to ourselves and successfully portray who we really are in this world. And this is what drives us. What drives us is to simply be who we are. And who are we? We are godly beings, a ray of divine light. When you explore the fascinating story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, you discover something quite amazing about the true motivation of mankind. As you may recall, Adam and Eve are in the garden, and what can we say? It's paradise. Everything is wonderful. You just reach up to the left, to the right, and there you have lush fruits just waiting there for you to eat. But in the garden is the snake. And the snake approaches Adam and Eve, and his job is to seduce them. What does the snake say to Adam and Eve? How does he try to convince them to transgress the will of God and eat from the forbidden fruits? What does the snake say to Adam and Eve? Does he try to allure them with, "Hey, Adam and Eve, if you eat from this tree, you guys will have the best sex life"? No. Does he say, "Hey, Adam, Eve, if you eat from this tree, you guys are going to be multimillionaires"? No. Does he say, "Hey, Adam, Eve, if you eat from this tree, you're going to be famous. They'll name apple juice after you"? No. What does the snake say to Adam and Eve that inspires them to eat from that tree? He says, "If you eat from that tree, you will be as God, knowers of good and evil." Now that is really the ultimate seduction to mankind. The truth is that nobody's interested in a great sex life, and nobody could care less about being famous. These are all symptoms of a much deeper core drive that moves us in our lives. It is the absolutely only thing, or actually no thing, that really interests us. It's to be who we are. And who are we? We're godly beings. As it says, God created mankind in his image, and we can't help but want to fulfill the image of who we are, divine, godly. And therefore, what we derive from this amazing story is that there really is only one motivation to the human being, and that's to simply be who we are. And now the question of choice is, are we going to choose a path that enables us to be who we really are in a genuine, authentic way, or are we going to choose a path that gives us a simulation of that, with the hopes that that will give us the true experience of our own godliness? But realize that really what ancient Jewish tradition is revealing is that even the desire to sin is rooted in the desire to be godly. That's all that matters. As I mentioned in previous talks, the goal of Kabbalah and the goal of Jewish tradition in general and the goal of Torah tradition in general is not to change who you are, but to empower you to be who you are. And the only real struggle in our lives and the only real choice in our lives is, do we choose a path that's authentic or do we choose ways that is counterfeit? That's really the choice. You know, people think that the choice between good and evil is like the choice between black and white. It's just going to be obvious. But the Kabbalah teaches us that the real high-grade choices in our lives, the true challenges that we will face, is not a choice between the obviously bad and the obviously good. Not between black and white, but between white and just a little off-white. It's really a choice between the real and the counterfeit. Imagine you walk into a supermarket and you hand the cashier a $100 bill. She takes one look at it. She says, "Oh, I'm sorry, sir. This is a worthless piece of paper. What are you talking about? I worked very hard for this. I mean, it's a $100 bill. Look in the corner. It says $100. I understand, sir, but if you look closely, you'll see that Washington's eyeball, the left eyeball, is just a little bit off. Well, what's the eyeball got to do with that? I mean, it's a $100 bill. I mean, his eyeball, I don't know. Let him have corrective glasses. I don't know. Hey, I mean, you know, it's a $100 bill. I'm sorry, sir, but this is a worthless piece of paper." So, too, the challenge in our life, the real challenges in our life, is between the real and the counterfeit. And that's really the choice that we have. And that's the only choice that we have in our lives. We can't help but want to be who we are. And the Kabbalah reveals to us who we are and why we are gravitating and why we are inspired towards what we want. Because we want to be godly. And that's because we are. But what is a true solution to feeling significant? Is it looking like $1 million? What's going to really empower us to feel truly loved? Is it by becoming part of some basketball team? What is going to truly empower us to feel loved? Is it an active sex life? What is it that's going to really make us feel that we're advancing in our lives? Is it seeing more and more money in our account? Or is it feeling that we ourselves are becoming more and more? Having more does not mean that you are more. The Kabbalah reveals to us that the solution to life is called service. We want to feel godly. The snake presented to Adam and Eve a counterfeit. If you set yourself up as your own God and try and be in and of yourself your own God, you can know for yourself. You decide for yourself what's good. You decide for yourself what's bad. You can be your own God. That is a counterfeit. That is bogus. Because we are not God, but we are rays of divine light. We are not the be-er, as I've spoken in previous talks. We are the beings. And therefore, the genuine path to personal fulfillment and real sense of significance, love, and growth is the path called service. The Kabbalah teaches that the solutions to all our problems is to serve God. And you know what? That probably sounds like a real put-off. And I understand why, as we've discussed in earlier talks. Because who wants to be servile? I don't want to be a slave. What's wrong with God? Is he some kind of ego cosmomaniac that wants me to do this and that and do it with a smile? He'll punish me? This goes back to our first talk, how our beliefs can make or break our lives. If you believe that God is some being floating in outer space over there, and he's asking you to do something, then it's a competitive kind of situation. It's like, why would I do what that big God over there wants me to do? It could only be out of fear, either fear of punishment or fear of losing the reward that he promised me. But it's not something that fulfills me. It's really about giving up what I want to do what he wants. I remember seeing a funny little underground film called Bambi Meets Godzilla. Wasn't a very long film. Basically, the film starts off with Bambi grazing out there in the field, and you've got this beautiful music in the background. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, bonk! And then you see this huge foot of Godzilla squash Bambi, and then all you see is a little bit of Bambi's feet sticking out of Godzilla's feet. And then there's about, the whole film was about 3 minutes, and then there's 20 minutes of credits, Bambi's toenails, Godzilla's toenails, wardrobe. But I wondered, why is that monster called Godzilla? Ever wonder about that? Because I think too many people think that the Israelites at Sinai heard, "I am Godzilla that took you out of Egypt. Therefore, you must serve me. You must fulfill my will, or I will squash you." But of course, as we discussed earlier, there is no such God. I remember one of my colleagues telling atheists, "The God you don't believe in, I don't believe in either." But as we've developed earlier, God is not a being floating in outer space, but rather God is the be-er, the source of all being. If God were a singer, we would be his singing. If God were a dancer, we would be his dancing. And of course, the greatest joy of a song is to be in service of its singer. And of course, the greatest joy of the dance is to be in service of its dancer. This is a very, very powerful teaching. The Kabbalah teaches that in the beginning, God created vessels. And then God projected into these vessels a thin ray of his divine light. But the vessels weren't able to take this light, and they exploded. And everything goes into chaos. And the rest of history is about how to pull those vessels together in order to receive the light. Now, it's interesting, in Hebrew, the word vessel is kli. But the truth is that the word kli could either mean container, vessel as a container, or kli could also mean vessel as a instrument or as a tool. What the Kabbalah is teaching is each one of these vessels, which is really a metaphor for us, thought that we were meant to be containers, to contain the light. We all wanted to consume the divine and feel as if we are the divine. And when you do that, the vessel breaks. But when you realize that you're not a kli in the sense of a container, but you're a kli in the sense of an instrument, a vehicle, a channel, then the light can come to you and flow through you into the world. And then not only do you not break, but you feel great. Yes, the Kabbalah teaches us that the secret to happiness, the secret to meaning, fulfillment, the greatest joy in our life is to serve God. But not serve some being floating out outer space over there where I have to give up myself to do what he wants. But to serve God, but God as the ultimate self, the universal, timeless source of all existence, the root, the ground, the context, the essence, the soul of all souls. The I am is your God who took you out of Egypt, as we discussed in our previous talks. Service is the secret to the greatest joy. Imagine you were a vending machine. And suddenly they put a sign on you that says, out of service. How painful that would be. Well, so too, each and every one of us is an instrument, a tool for God. Recall what Friedrich Nietzsche said. Although Nietzsche is known for saying God is dead, he's not so well known for saying, unless a person feels a greater whole working through them, their life has no meaning. What was Nietzsche talking about? I agree with him. God is dead. If God is some being floating in outer space over there who has a long white beard and lightning bolts ready to strike me, then that God is dead. There's no such God. In reality, there is no such God. But when Kabbalah refers to the divine, the Kabbalah is referring to reality, ultimate reality. Reality is what we call God, or actually what we, in Jewish tradition, refer to as Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, Adonai, the source, the ground, the essence, the soul of all souls. And the greatest joy in our lives is to selflessly serve the ultimate self, the ultimate I. The I am is God your God who took you out of Egypt. And this is quite remarkable. I remember sharing this idea with a screenwriter, a very successful screenwriter in Hollywood. He was very excited about this idea. He said, you know, Rabbi, let me share with you something I've never shared with anybody. Whenever I come into the office to work, I have a little prayer. I say, please, God, use me. And you know what, Rabbi? I have to honestly tell you, I did not write any of these films. I was merely a vehicle, a channel for the creative spirit of God. I said to him, Dan, that's true about the good ones, but the bad ones, those are yours. So there's sometimes bad ones. Sometimes we're not quite the vessel, the vehicle, the channel we could be. But the goal is to be godly, because we are godly beings, manifestations of the divine, rays of divine light. And our greatest joy is to be a vehicle for that ultimate I, to get the ego out of the way and be a vehicle, a channel for God. I must confess that my best moment as a public speaker is when I am no longer speaking. When I feel that it's not me, when I feel that I just get out of the way and somehow become a mouthpiece, that I'm just a radio, and that it's really not coming from me. I recall some very fascinating moments where at the end of my talk, people would ask me questions. And I am stunned because people would ask me questions, and I'm challenged because I don't have the answer. And suddenly I hear myself giving an answer, and a little voice inside me says, shut up, David, like you don't know what you're talking about. But an answer comes out of me, and everyone in the room, including myself, goes, whoa. And I know, you know what? I go, whoa, because in that moment of service, you become like a glove. And the hand of God just fits right in. And those are the greatest moments of our life, that egoless moment where we can be who we are, souls, rays of light, expressions of the divine, in service of the ultimate. Serving God means connecting to the source. It doesn't mean submitting to some kind of egomaniac in the sky who wants you to do whatever he wants you to do. To serve God really means to portray divine qualities in this world, to be a channel for God's presence in this world. The Kabbalah teaches us that the ingredients to God's presence are referred to as the Sefirot, the 10 divine attributes: will, wisdom, understanding, truth, love, care, beauty, compassion, justice. When we're being merciful, then we're serving the source of all mercy. When we're acting intelligently, we're serving the source of all intelligence. When we are fighting for the cause of justice, then we are serving the source of all justice. What's the path to ultimate fulfillment and meaning in our lives? Is when we can become a means to an end greater than ourselves. What really is the meaning of meaning? Think about it. The meaning of meaning is that I am a means to an end greater than myself. Very often people think that the commandments are like kind of like brownie points. You know, you do another one, you do another one. I remember I was dating this woman, and often when, this of course before I got married, I remember when I was dating a woman, and I used to ask my date, envision a day in the life of your home. So this one woman said, what comes to my mind immediately is a good deed chart on the refrigerator door. And every time the children do a good deed, they get a little star. And I guess she probably kind of sensed that I was a little disappointed in her response. So she turned to me and said, well, what do you envision? And I said, well, I don't know. When I think of my home, I just think of a home filled with light. She said, that'll run you a high electrical bill. So I obviously realized that we're not quite a match. But I wonder sometimes people think that maybe God has some big refrigerator in the sky, and that on his refrigerator door is our good deed chart. And maybe God has like an oven, and in his oven, he's got a bad deed chart. But you know what? That is not the deepest of the deepest. Because really what Jewish wisdom teaches us is that the reward for doing good is the doing good. And the punishment for doing bad is the doing bad. Because really the choice in life is, do you fulfill the drive for emunah? Do you portray yourself or do you betray yourself? You are a spark. You are an expression of the divine, a ray of divine light. Are you thinking, speaking, and acting in ways that are harmonious with who you are? Are you a living expression of God's love, compassion, truth in the world? Or are you living a lie? Are you seeking ways to feel godly, ways that are only a quick fix but don't really express who you are, or more importantly, who God is and how God seeks to be expressed who you are? A great Jewish philosopher once said, animals have needs, but human beings have a need to be needed. Animals want to be satisfied, but human beings want to not only be satisfied, but want to satisfy the needs of others. A profound point, again, a deep insight to who we are. If we are a channel, a tool, an instrument for the divine, how could we not want to serve? We have a need to be needed, and the reason why we have a need to be needed is because God lovingly chose to need us and to make us into a vehicle for an expression of himself. As long as you think you are the be-all and end-all, then you will ultimately feel. When a person feels like they are the be-all and end-all of life, that's really the end of their life. But when you realize that you are a means to an end greater than yourself, your life becomes so filled with meaning. The great Kabbalist, Rabbi Isaac Luria, referred to as the Arizal, the great lion, was known for remarkable ability to diagnose people based on a exercise of visualization. The Arizal would ask people to close their eyes and visualize the Hebrew word for the divine. The Yud, the Hey, the Vav, and the Hey. He would then ask them to describe what they see. And very often the patient would have difficulties focusing on the entire word. Sometimes one letter would flash in and out. Sometimes a letter wouldn't appear at all. Sometimes only a part of the letter. He would ask them, what colors do they see? And some people would see a gold letter, and some people would see a gold word, and some people would see silver. Some people would see fire. Some people would see the name of the divine on a black background, and some people would see the name of the divine on a purple background. And according to the nuances of the visualization of this divine name, the Yud, the Hey, the Vav, the Hey, the Arizal, Rabbi Isaac Laurier, would begin to diagnose with absolute incredible precision exactly what is wrong with the person, what is ailing them, and he would prescribe what good deed, what commandment, what mitzvah they are negligent in. Fascinating. Now, I can't do that yet, but I can share with you the dynamics behind the power of this visualization. Because really, that's who we are. We have come into this world to spell the truth of God. We are servants, vehicles, channels for the presence of God to make God, to facilitate the manifestation of God on earth. And therefore, the visualization, the ability for ourselves to project the name of God in our mind, correlates to the ability that we are projecting the presence of God on earth. And each one of those letters, and every aspect of the letters, is a reflection of how well we are making God's presence clear in the world. Do people see the presence of God in the world, or do we behave in a manner that throws that presence out of the world? This is really our choice as human beings. Our choice is whether to succeed at self-portrayal. And self-portrayal means that as a soul, as an expression of God, we are portraying divinity in the world. We are portraying love, portraying kindness, portraying truth in the world. Or are we betraying ourselves? And even when we're betraying ourselves, we may be deluding ourselves because we're finding bogus ways to make ourselves feel significant. Fake ways to make ourselves feel as if we really are included in belonging, and all kinds of counterfeit ways to make us feel as if we really are growing and really are advancing. The Kabbalah teaches us that we are souls, an aspect of the divine, a ray of divine light. We are tools, instruments, channels for God's presence in the world. Our greatest joy is service. Our ultimate prayer is, please, God, use me. And when people feel sad and people feel depressed, and they go to therapy, and they talk about this that happened or that that happened or their mother or their father, then is that always going to help them? Very often the reason why people are sad is because they're too self-centered, because all they think about and talk about and concerned about is themselves. But when you put yourself in service, serving others, serving the divine, serving to bring love into the world and serving to bring compassion in the world, then you'll feel worthwhile again. Then you'll feel happy again. The secret to happiness, the secret to peace, inner peace, is when we can be who we are meant to be. And who are we meant to be? Vessels, vehicles. Now imagine you were a radio and they're using you as a doorstop. Imagine how you'd feel. Imagine if you were a buzzsaw and they were using you to cut cheese when you know that you could be cutting trees. I don't know if that's so PC to talk about cutting trees, but, you know, you get my point. Imagine that you are a pen, and rather than using you for creativity, for writing wisdom and important ideas in the world. They're using you to write garbage. How would you feel? So too, you decide what kind of instrument, what kind of tool you want to be. Do you want to be a tool for God? Do you want to be an instrument for divine presence to flow into this world? Or do you want to dedicate yourself to achieving that which isn't so important, that which isn't so powerful, that which isn't so productive in the world? Service is the secret. Through service, the soul soars.
Why You Will Never Die: Awakening to the Immortal You and the Afterlife. The fear of death haunts us our whole life. Anticipating our final end, plus knowing that it could be any day, fills us with anxiety, trying to cram in every pleasure while it lasts. Can we ever rest in peace while we are alive, or are we doomed to always feel rushed and tense? The Kabbalah teaches that death is an illusion and that the quality of your life before death determines your afterlife. Learn how to overcome your constant present tense and bring the delights of the eternal life into your here and now.
Many years ago, I did a talk in Manhattan. The title was Secrets to Immortality from the Kabbalah. But there was an error in the ad, and it read Secrets to Immortality from the Kabbalah. Needless to say, I got a great turnout. One of the powerful teachings of the Kabbalah is that death is an illusion, that you and I will never die. If you recall the story I shared in the second talk about the drunken fellow who thought that by killing himself, he would be happy. In a strange way, of course, killing ourselves won't make us happy, but in a strange way, we intuit a self that transcends the particular time, space, me. We intuit a self that goes on beyond this life. And yet, what really does death mean for us? Death is an illusion, but why are we even struggling with this illusion? And it goes right back to the first story that we've discussed a number of times in these talks, the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. In the Garden of Eden, Adam is warned that if they eat from the tree of knowledge of good and bad, death they will die. Now, of course, we all know in the story that after they eat of the tree of knowledge of good and bad, they don't die. So then what does it mean, death you will die? The Kabbalah teaches that really, initially Adam and Eve were not going to die, but rather they were going to evolve to higher and higher levels of consciousness. But now they will have to endure the pain and the suffering of death, the separation of body and soul. Originally, both the body and soul would evolve to a higher forms. But now, after Adam and Eve fatally chose to disregard the will of God, they now are subject to mortality. And greater than death is the fear of death, because death happens just once in your life. But the fear of death is every single day. There's a story about two rabbis who made a deal that if one of them dies before the other, he will come back and tell him what death was like. And in fact, he came back and he said, death was pretty good. But the truth is that even if they send me back, I will put up a fight because I don't want to have to deal with that daily fear of death. Where does the fear of death come from? Really, what the snake was saying to Adam and Eve is, you don't have to do what God says. You can define yourself. You're independent. You can be self-sufficient. You too can be a God. And essentially, the message of the snake is the message of ego. Really, what is ego saying to us? Ego is constantly trying to convince us that we are self contain, that in and of ourselves we have meaning, we have value. And that message is a lie. But it's worse than a lie, because that message is actually the message of death. When we deny ourselves the joy of identifying with God as the great self, realizing that the powers within us are not from us, when we disconnect from our source, we create a lifestyle called death. Death becomes a lifestyle, because if we choose to define ourselves in terms of ourselves and cut ourselves off from the source of life, then essentially what's going on is we have chosen death. Isn't that really what the Bible says? God says to mankind, I have placed before you blessing and curse, life and death. Choose life. Well, how does a person choose death? It's when they choose to live the life of ego. Because really what ego is trying to convince us is that we are self-defined and we can do whatever we want. And really when we do wrong, really when we betray the will of God, we are ripping ourselves off from the soul of all souls. As we've learned numerous times in this series, you are a soul and I am a soul. And we don't exist independently. Rather, we are connected to the soul of all souls. And when we deny ourselves that connectivity, or when we actually deny ourselves the experience of our connectivity to the divine, then we've really ripped ourselves off. It is the big rip-off. Doing wrong is just a big rip-off, because mortality is really cutting ourselves off from the source of life. And what does Adam do and Eve do when they make this bold move to define for themselves what they think is good, what they think is bad, and decide that they can have an independent existence separate from God? Suddenly they feel weak, suddenly they feel challenged, and now they're hiding. But that's so ridiculous. How can you hide from yourself? How can you hide from your great self? That's like the thought in the mind of the thinker trying to hide from his thinker. Totally ridiculous. But that's the kind of ridiculous thinking that the ego tries to convince us. The ego tries to convince us that God is a being floating in outer space over there, and we have an independent existence separate from God over here, and that when God asks us to do what he asks us to do, he's really trying to undermine our strength, and it's really about subordination. And we don't want to be subordinate, but that's the ego talk. The soul teaches that we are one with God, and the ego tries to convince us that we exist separate of God. And the Kabbalah reveals to us that really the journey of the soul is to break from what it describes as the hard shell of ego. The hard shell of ego, once again, is that the ego tries to define itself in terms of itself. I begin to confuse myself to think that I'm self-defined, independent, self-sufficient, self-contained. That the Kabbalah refers to as klipa. A hard shell, as if some shell is cutting us off from the rest of reality. And in fact, the Kabbalah teaches that before Adam and Eve sinned, they had bodies, but they had bodies of light. The bodies were made of light. There was a distinction. There was a sense of distinction between themselves and the rest of reality, but there was no sense of separation. But when Adam and Eve chose to define themselves in terms of themselves, they then confine themselves. And suddenly we experience ourselves in a physical body that separates us and sets us off and separate from the rest of the world. Suddenly we feel like we have to save our skins. We begin to experience ourselves encased in this body. When the truth is, when you think of it, the only body we know is the one that we cognate with our minds. So I ask you, how do we know that our minds are in our bodies? Perhaps our bodies are really only in our minds. And really the Kabbalah teaches is that our bodies are in our minds, and yet our minds are really also in our bodies. The Kabbalah refers to this as Or Makif, encompassing light, an or pnimi, inner light. The body is in the mind, and yet the mind is in the body. But the original body of Adam and Eve was not a body of material, not a physical body, but a body of light, a body of light which indicated to us, expressed that there is distinction. I'm not you, you're not me, and we are not the divine. There is a distinction between ourselves and the rest of reality, between ourselves and God. But there is no separation. But once Adam and Eve bought into the seduction of the snake and confused themselves to think that they can and they do exist separate from God, then in fact, that's what you get. If that's what you believe, then that's what you perceive, and that's what you receive in your life, a sense of separation. And the Kabbalah teaches us that the journey of the soul is to break free of this illusion of the ego, to break free of the illusion of the body, suggesting that we're encased in this bag of skin, and free to experience ourselves at one, not one and the same with each other, not one and the same as God, but at one with each other, and one with the divine. And in fact, that's what's so interesting. When a person does wrong, then they seek atonement. What really does atonement mean? Atonement means at one mint. And that's really what happens when we do wrong, when we do other than the will of the divine, when we seek to serve ourselves and not serve the divine. Then we actually undermine ourselves and further fuel this mistake, this confusion that we exist separately. And the soul needs to break out of this illusion, break free from the ego, and experience the freedom of the connection to the ultimate self, to the divine, to God. And now the question is, will the soul gather in its own strength to break free of the prison of ego thinking? Or will we need some external stimuli of pain, challenge, to empower us to make the break? Ego says it's my life and I'm doing it my way. Pain challenges that, reminds us that there's a power beyond ourselves. Ego says, I'm alone. I'm in control. Ego says, I alone am in control of my life. Pain says, are you so sure? Pain is not God's revenge for our wrongdoings. Rather, God compassionately offers an alternative path to the same end. The soul seeks to break free of the illusion of self-contained and the delight and the ecstasy of feeling one with the source, one with God. And now the question is, can we do it on our own, or do we need some kind of external stimuli to help us? Pain is not God's revenge. God is compassionately offering us an alternative path to where we all want to get to. Rabbi Akiva, the great rabbi, said, suffering is precious to me. Why? Because he understood that pain in one's life can be an empowering experience to distance themselves from their ego thinking and free themselves to that connectivity with God. Pain, from the soul's perspective, is really a healing process, but from the ego's perspective, is a punishment. The Kabbalah teaches us that God is not interested in punishing us. In fact, most of us are punishing ourselves. God is actually saying, be compassionate towards yourself. Go easy. Why are you doing this to yourself? But really what God is doing for us is God is compassionately offering us an opportunity to help empower us, to free us from the illusions of our ego. Imagine if you eat unhealthy food and your stomach hurts. Is that because your stomach is punishing you? No, of course not. It's because your stomach is trying to overcome something that isn't quite right with your stomach. I remember a number of years ago, my wife and I decided that we would try and start eating healthy. So we went to a dietitian and we got on a great diet of brown rice and soya milk, and it was going pretty good for a while. My wife and I were feeling really quite happy about the diet, feeling really great. So we decided to kind of celebrate our diet, and we went out and got ourselves some junk food. And boy, did we get sick. I couldn't understand this. Here we are eating this healthy food, and we have just a little bit of junk food, and we get sick. Before, we were eating junk food, and we were feeling really great. So I call this dietitian, and I say to him, hey, listen, I don't understand what's going on. You're making me sick. I used to eat junk food easy and feel great about it. He said, no, you don't understand. Before, you were really sick. Because before, you were eating junk food and your body was no longer in any way reacting to this bad stuff. Now you're healthy. A healthy body will respond bad to junk food. So to our soul, a healthy soul will respond to junk thinking, junk speaking, junk actions. And the pain that the soul feels is a healthy pain, inspiring the soul to make a choice, to make a change in lifestyle. And ignoring that pain is only to turn it into suffering. Ignoring that pain is only bringing upon ourselves ultimate disaster. I remember many years ago, I went to a dentist and he tapped on my tooth and he said, does this hurt? And I said, no. So he says, well, did it hurt? And I said to him, well, yeah, actually, about 3 months ago, it hurt a lot, but I just ignored it and the pain went away. He said, yeah, of course the pain went away because it's dead. Your tooth is dead and it needs root canal. I said, what do you mean it's dead? He said, you should have come to me when it was in pain because that was a sign that it was alive. But now that it's dead, you don't feel pain. Pain is a healthy reaction to unhealthy situations. Whether it's physical pain or whether it's spiritual pain, all pain is actually God's gift to us, to empower us, to inspire us, to make a shift in our thinking, a shift in our acting, to free ourselves from egotistical delusions that we are self-defined and self-contained. Free ourselves to the ecstasy of realizing that we are one with God, embraced within His reality, filled with His Spirit. When Adam and Eve ate of the tree of knowledge of good and bad, they fell into ego consciousness and they chose the path of death. But it's important to understand that death, like pain, is not a threat. Death is merely a reminder that in and of yourself, you are not whole. And death is experienced as a threat only when you stubbornly deny its message. But when you accept the message of death, it actually becomes the key to life. Our response to death should be, yes, death, you are right. My body and ego will die, but I am not my body, nor am I my ego. I'm a soul. I'm a part of the great immortal I, and I will live on. Jewish tradition talks about an experience called dying by a kiss. To die by a kiss of God is actually not a leaving of this world, but a homecoming. There are really two types of death. One death is painful, and one death is ecstatic. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not glorifying death here. We're not looking forward to death. But rather, we need to understand that death is really a message to help us tap into eternal life. The idea of the kiss of death is really this homecoming. It's realization of our connection to God. The soul leaves the body to unite with God because the soul is leaving the body consciousness, the illusion that I am separate and that I'm contained in this physical body. We reunite with our light body. We reunite with the consciousness that we are distinct. And yet we are one with God. A story is told of a great holy man who is on his deathbed, and his wife begins to cry. He turns to her and says, "Oh, sweetheart, please don't cry. My whole life has been in preparation for this moment." Now, of course, again, we're not living to die, but we are choosing death as a lifestyle, as long as we identify with the illusionary perspective that we exist separate from the divine. I recall a story of a man who lost his son. And of course, that would be a very devastating experience. Many people tried to console this man, but none were able to. And then a rabbi explained to him, "You know, when a baby is born, the baby cries, but the parents rejoice and say congratulations. When the soul leaves the body, it's actually born into a higher world. And we cry, but the angels say congratulations." We love our bodies. We love the characters we play. But as a vehicle for the individual expression of divinity into the world, but not as the source of self. To choose life means to find yourself within the great self. To do that is to let go of fear. To do that is to know that you, the soul, will never die. And to do that means to come home. Just like the Beatles sang, get back to where you once belonged. And where we belonged is in our connection to the divine. The Kabbalah describes various ways that a person leaves this world. The Kabbalah teaches us that when a person dies, they are present at their own funeral. Yes, here you are. You leave your body, and there you are at your own funeral, and you hear people talking about you. Now, depending on how you lived your life, will determine what kind of experience that funeral will be. Are you going to hear people saying these wonderful, kind things about you? Or are you going to overhear people saying, "Oh, finally, what took him so long? Oh, you write the eulogy. No, you write the eulogy. I don't have nothing to say about this guy." And imagine how painful that will be if that's what you hear. The Kabbalah explains that at your funeral, you will watch them bury your body. Once again, the choices you make in your life will determine how this is going to feel. Because if you chose to identify your self-worth with your body, if you were Mr. Universe umpteen times, and your whole self-value was bound up with your beautiful physique, now imagine you see them burying your body in the ground. The Talmud teaches, part of the oral Jewish tradition, that the worms to the deceased are like pins to his side. Now, what is it talking about? What kind of pins to what kind of side? What could this be? But from the Kabbalah, we understand that we see the worms eat our bodies. And again, now, don't get me wrong, no one's going to love watching this, but it all depends on the choices of our lives. If we choose to identify with our bodies as the source of our self-worth. Well, to see worms eating our body will be devastating. But on the other hand, if we know that our body is like our car, a vehicle that we use, a very important vehicle, and of course we love our bodies, but we never thought it was the source of our self-worth. We always anchored ourselves in the ultimate self, and that God, in our service to God, making God's purpose our purpose, to bring His presence, His qualities, His love into the world. Well, then we will be challenged because, listen, we do feel a little attached to our bodies. We won't feel devastated by what we see. In addition, once we leave the funeral, it's explained that we are as if in a theater. And there you are in the theater, and you're, well, pretty good. I've spent much of my life watching movies. This is great. Say you turn to the fellow beside you, and you say, "Hey, tell me, what's playing?" He says, "What's playing? Oh, you'll see. It's actually a double feature." "Oh, wow, terrific. A double feature. Wow. Well, what's it about?" "Oh, you'll see." And suddenly on the screen is the title of the first movie. The title is How You Lived Your Life, and you are the star. It's all about you. Okay, well, you go through your life. But then the second movie is How You Could Have Lived Your Life. And how well those two movies match will determine whether you're in the theater of hell or the theater of heaven. The Kabbalah teaches that when the soul leaves the body based on the choices it makes, there are a number of options where the soul could go. The soul could either go to a realm called the Garden of Eden. And what happens in the Garden of Eden, referred to in Hebrew as Gan Eden, is that the soul suddenly is able to totally enjoy the meaning of service. Because when we're in our body consciousness, which continuously tries to convince us that we exist separate, independent of anything greater than ourselves, then service seems to be in conflict with our body. And we don't really, really experience in a sensual way the joy of service. Not like we experience the joy of eating a pizza. When we eat a pizza, we get a buzz. But when we do a kind act, we feel this profound sense of fulfillment, but it's not as visceral. Sometimes it can be quite strong, but it's not quite as strong as the direct pleasure and the immediate feedback we get from physical pleasures. When we finally are able to leave our body consciousness, when we're finally able to leave ego consciousness, the confusing perspective that we are self-contained, and now we're in the Garden of Eden, there we are able to enjoy in the deepest, most profound, and most sensual way the ecstasy of the life of service. However, that's a person who based their life on service. That's a person who chose to identify with the divine and chose to realize themselves as a soul, as a tool, as an instrument and vehicle for the divine. But there's somewhere else the soul can go, and that's called Gehenna, or loosely translated as hell. Now, don't get too worried about that, because in Jewish tradition, the max you can get is 12 months. So it's not eternal. Now, what does that mean? What happens in Gehenna? Well, Gehenna is this profound pain where suddenly we are feeling the heat of the shame of how we betrayed ourselves, how we betrayed what is truly worth living for, how we denied ourselves the joy of living in service. and we get that sudden realization of how we could have lived our lives and didn't live our lives. And through that pain and that realization and that deep sense of regret of how we lived our lives in an ego consciousness way, we are able to slowly transition ourselves and move into Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden. In other words, the Kabbalah teaches us that hell is actually a gateway to the Garden of Eden, and that really it's a transition, a kind of healing station to get over the mistakes that we made, reorient ourselves so that we can be ready to receive the joyous experience of connectivity to God and purely enjoy the good deeds that we did in our lives, which were in fact in service of God. But what if we're not ready even for Gehenim? Well, then the Kabbalah teaches us that we could come back. And that's called reincarnation, or in Hebrew, that's called Gilgul Neshamot. In other words, this is kind of like, let's make a deal. What's behind door number one, door number two, door number three? So door number one is you go straight to the Garden of Eden, where you are able to enjoy in the fullest way, in the most visceral way, the truth of the service that you lived. But if you're not ready for that, and you need a little healing, you need a little waking up to do, so then you go to Gehenna, to hell. But you couldn't be in hell for longer than 12 months. It's only a temporary transition, kind of cleansing, refining experience to prepare yourself to get to Gan Eden, to experience the joy of who you are and what you're part of, or actually who you're part of, your connectivity to God. But if you're not ready for that, then you come back and you play another character. And the character that you're given to play is exactly the character you need to play to overcome ego and choose a life of service. Choose a life of being soul. There's a great story by Rav Nachman of Breslov, the great Hasidic master. It's a story about a fellow, we'll call him Harry, who dies, a miserly, mean fellow, but a multimillionaire. And he dies, and there he is standing in heaven's court. And they say, Harry, you blew it. We're going to send you back as a multimillionaire. Harry says, oh, no, please don't do that. Ha, my money blinded me. I was so self-wrapped up. I was so self-absorbed. Please don't send me back as a rich man. Please send me back as a poor man. Just out of poverty. No, I'm sorry. Sorry, Harry, you got to go back and play it again. We're going to send you back as a multimillionaire. Oh, please, no, please, I beg of you. Please have compassion on me. Please send me back as a pauper. The court says, okay, Harry, we'll consider that. The court then decides after some discussion, okay, Harry, we're going to send you back as a poor man. Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. So they send the soul, Harry, into this world, born to a poverty-stricken family in some poor area. And Harry suffered poverty. And what did he do with his suffering and his poverty? He just became a miserly, cruel, angry man, a criminal. Harry dies after many years, and there he is standing once again in front of the heavenly tribune. And the court says, oh, Harry, you're back here. No, you don't understand. I was a poor pauper. Please, I beg you, if I were rich, if I were wealthy, I wouldn't have been this way. Harry, did you forget? You were here last time. You begged us to be a poor man. That was our gift to you. When we come back into this world, the exact character we're giving, the kind of mother, the kind of father, the kind of financial setting, the abilities or the disabilities, the talents, the weaknesses, everything is perfectly designed to give us exactly the scenario that we need to this time deal with who are we, ego or soul? What really gives our life meaning? Do we think that we are meaningful in and of ourselves as self-contained, independent, separate entities encased in our bodies? Or do we realize that we are souls, rays of light, vehicles for the manifestation of divinity in the world? Every single one of us is given the exact character and the exact situation, the exact setting, for just the kind of choices we need to make in order to make the break from the life of ego. The Kabbalah reveals that after death, there is another experience, but this experience is the most horrifying of all experiences. This is called getting stuck between two worlds. What does it mean to get stuck between two worlds? This is a soul, this is a person who so depended on their material, physical identity for their self-worth that when they die, they simply can't let go at all. And yet nonetheless, they die. So what happens is they leave their body, but they don't leave this world. And now they are trapped between two worlds because they're not in the physical world, but they're also not in the other world. So they are, I guess, what in modern day would be referred to as a ghost. Now what happens? What does this soul try to do? This soul tries to find a body to possess. And this is what you might have heard is called the dibbuk. The dibbuk is a soul that has possessed another person's body. And, you know, sometimes people just go crazy and people say, I don't know what got into him. But what could have gotten into him is a soul that is trying to get back into this physical world. Now, how does one become vulnerable to such a soul? How does one become vulnerable to becoming possessed? Now, I remember many, many years ago, I saw the movie The Exorcist. Whoa, was that a gruesome movie? And I remember eating that night in a pizzeria with my friends and talking about how gory that movie was with the green vomit and all that. And in walked a fellow who was a man that was teaching me Judaism at the time. So I told him that we had just come back from the movie The Exorcist. He says, oh, yeah, you know, none of that's in Judaism. That's ridiculous. I said, oh, really? Oh, that's ridiculous. Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that. Well, then years later, when I started the study of Kabbalah, suddenly I discovered that it's not so ridiculous. Now, the green vomit is ridiculous, but actually the Kabbalah records incidents in history of exorcisms done by rabbis. Because it is in fact possible that a soul that is trapped between two worlds tries to get back into this world. And this soul is either trying to get back into this world to stay, or this soul is trying to get back into this world through this body to make some kind of choice of service, of reorientation, of identification, to release itself finally from this world and go on to either reincarnation or Gehenim, or hopefully at the best scenario, of course, is the Garden of Eden. The Talmud teaches us that there's two ways of dying. One way is like hair being pulled out of cream. It's smooth. But another way is like cotton being pulled out of a thorn bush. It's messy. We decide the kind of death we die by the kinds of choices we make in our lives. If we identify with the ego, if we seek self-worth through the material things of this world, then death becomes so overwhelmingly challenging and frightening, because death is telling me that I'm going to lose it all. But if we realize that it's not the things in life that give us value, but it's the no things in life, it's the divine values, it's the divine attributes that we embody, it's the divine attributes that we are a vehicle for in the world in service of God, then we leave this world like hair being pulled out of cream. A smooth transition into our lives. A smooth transition into the next world. So the Kabbalah teaches us that death is really an illusion. So why are we afraid of death? Where did death come from when Adam and Eve chose to eat of the tree of knowledge of good and bad? They actually chose to identify with the message of ego. I am self-contained, self-sufficient, self-sustaining, self-defined. I exist separate from the rest of reality. When we made that choice, we experienced ourselves in a body that constantly suggests that we, in fact, are set off from and exist apart from the rest of reality. But soul knows that we don't exist apart from reality, but that we exist as a part of reality, a part of God. And now death is really the key to life, because death is trying to tell us that the body is not everything. Death is trying to tell us that our physical existence is not everything. And if we embrace the message of death, we will be able to free ourselves from the chains of ego and discover our deep connection to the ultimate self, to the divine. Death is an illusion. I am not going to die. You are not going to die. David Aaron is going to die. I am going to leave my body, but I am not my body. I am a soul, a ray of the divine light. I love my body. The Kabbalah teaches us, and ancient Jewish wisdom teaches us, that there will come a time called the revival of the dead. The soul leaves the body, but we will come back to our body. We love our body, but we love our body as a vehicle for the expression of God in the world. Once our body becomes a container rather than an instrument, once our body cuts us off from the source of life rather than a vehicle for the source of life, then death becomes a challenge every day of our lives. You are immortal, and I am immortal. But do you believe that? Do you live a life based on that? Do you understand that serving the divine is the true source of awakening to the immortal self?
You've been listening to Kabbalah Works, Awakening to Your Purpose, Passion, and Power, written and read by Rabbi David Aaron. This has been a Gildan Audio production.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.